We helped her, but she helped us more. She has taught me that there always is a future.
Life Changing on BBC Sounds and Radio 4 starts next Wednesday morning at 9.
This is BBC Radio 4.
Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Thursday the 31st of October. This is Today with Johnny Diamond and Nick Robinson.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has won the backing of the International Monetary Fund for yesterday's budget and its blockbuster increases in spending, taxation and borrowing. We speak to the Chancellor at 8:10 and her predecessor, the Shadow Chancellor, will have analysis throughout the programme. And emergency teams in Spain are searching for those still missing after floods killed at least 95 people.
Also in today's programme,
we're meeting a woman, Elena, who had gone into a building to get a manicure, and then she heard a loud explosion, and when she came out, she found a drone had dropped a bomb on her car.
Our correspondent Yogita Lemaya reports from the Kherson region in Ukraine, where drone attacks have surged in the past few months. It's Halloween. We'll get more recommendations of scary stories for our children's book club. And when words fail us, as they did just then, Radio 4 Comedy is here.
You know the person, the neighbour, who always puts their bin out first on bin day? You know exactly which one it is. Everyone else follows suit. They are a binfluencer.
Susie Dent, who else? The lexicographer joins the comedian Phil Wang to tell us about their new radio show, Unspeakable, Make Up the Words We Really Need. All that after the BBC News, read this morning by Caroline Nichols.
In a rare move, the International Monetary Fund has welcomed the measures announced by the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, in her budget yesterday. She unveiled tax increases worth about £40 billion in order to increase investment and spending on public services. Employers have voiced concern that they're bearing the brunt of the biggest tax rises in a generation, as our economics editor Faisal Islam reports.
The IMF, which last week told BBC News that a boost to investment was much needed, backed sustainably raising revenue, i.e. tax rises, to help reduce the deficit, the addressing of urgent pressures in public spending, and some changes to the rules constraining borrowing. It was helpful support to the Chancellor after she decided on blockbuster increases in spending, taxation, borrowing and investment. A £76 billion a year rise in spending will take taxation to the highest level on record and spending closer to continental European levels. The UK is set for the highest sustained level of public investment in major capital projects for 50 years. Some businesses have expressed concern about shouldering the increase in the tax burden, with particular backlash on the application of inheritance tax to agricultural land.
Emergency teams in Spain are searching for those missing in the worst floods to hit the country in decades. At least 95 people have been killed, nearly all of them in the Valencia region, where a year's worth of rain fell in just 8 hours yesterday. Many roads are blocked by mud, debris and cars which had been swept away. Our Europe correspondent Bethany Bell sent this report from Valencia.
Spain is reeling from what's been described as one of the worst natural disasters in its recent history. Rescue workers are struggling to find the missing. Officials say it's not yet clear how many people are still unaccounted for. Some places can only be reached by helicopter. Hundreds of soldiers have been deployed to help with the rescue effort. Some local officials have complained that the flood warnings came too late. The Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, said those affected would not be abandoned. He extended his condolences to those who'd lost their loved ones. "The whole of Spain weeps with you," he said. 3 days of mourning have been declared.
A typhoon has hit the east coast of Taiwan, bringing winds gusting at more than 120 miles an hour. Called Kongrei, the storm is the largest hit Taiwan since 1996. All schools and offices have been shut and most rail services and all domestic flights cancelled. New analysis suggests that human-caused climate change has made the 10 deadliest extreme weather events of the last 20 years more intense and more likely. The killer storms, heat waves and floods left at least 570,000 people dead across Europe, Africa and Asia. The study has been released to mark the 10th anniversary of the World Weather Attribution Team at Imperial College London. Here's our climate editor, Justin Rowlatt.
The World Weather Attribution Team developed the science that allows researchers to discern the fingerprint of climate change in individual weather events. The deadliest of the last two decades was the drought that hit Somalia in 2011, which is thought to have killed more than 250,000 people. Today's study found it and storms, floods and heat waves were made both more likely and more extreme by a warming climate. The scientists said their findings underscored how dangerous extreme weather events had already become.
North Korea has fired an intercontinental ballistic missile, which flew for nearly an hour and a half before falling into the sea near Japan. The North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, said it was a warning to enemies. Our correspondent, Shami Khalil, reports from Tokyo.
Pyongyang said the intercontinental ballistic missile launch set a record exceeding their previous tests. The defense ministry in Tokyo said the ICBM was in the air for 1 hour and 26 minutes, longer than any other missile tested by the North. Defense officials in Seoul have said the test was intended to develop weapons that fire farther and higher, adding that it was possibly aimed at increasing the payload of the missile. South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff say the missile was launched from near Pyongyang and flew around more than 600 miles east before landing near Japan outside the country's territorial waters. Officials in Seoul said the missile might have used a newly developed solid fuel booster. They added that it was fired at a sharply high angle, which implies the missile could fly far into the Pacific towards the United States if fired at a lower angle.
Protection zones around abortion clinics in England and Wales come into force today. It'll be illegal to protest within 150 metres of a centre or to try to influence someone's decision to use their services. The same rules are already in place in Scotland and Northern Ireland. Katrin Nye reports.
These buffer zones mean handing out anti-abortion leaflets within the area will be illegal. So will obstructing people using or working at a clinic. Anyone found guilty of breaking the law will face an unlimited fine. What won't be banned in these zones, though, is silent prayer. The government says police will be issued new guidance on this and will deal with it on a case-by-case basis. One charity said what the government's calling safe access zones couldn't come soon enough, but an anti-abortion organisation said women would lose access to vital practical support.
The world's richest man, Elon Musk, has been told to appear in court in Pennsylvania later today after his political campaign group started giving away $1 million each day to a different voter in key states in the US presidential election. The Philadelphia district attorney has described the scheme as an illegal lottery. Mr. Musk, a high-profile backer of Donald Trump, offers the chance to win the cash prize to voters who sign his petition supporting free speech and gun rights.
Caroline, thank you very much indeed. 7 minutes past six. Let's head over to the BBC Weather Centre, see how grey it's going to be today with Elizabeth Ritzini. Morning to you, Elizabeth.
Hello, good morning, Nick. Yes, it's going to be another rather grey day for most of us. High pressure still dominant, so it is dry and settled, and it will also feel mild again for the time of year. And this weather pattern is set to stay largely as we head through the next few days at least. So a dry day in prospect for most today. We do have some rain across far northwest of Scotland, though. It's a fog start for some of us. Some dense patches of fog across Oxfordshire, Wiltshire and Somerset this morning, so reduced visibility here. For many central, southern and eastern areas of the UK, it will stay completely dry, light winds, and we'll see the early mist and fog lift and clear as we head through the morning. A few sunny spells developing to the lee of high ground, especially for parts of eastern coastal areas of England, towards northern areas of East Anglia and also across parts of northeast Scotland too. For Northern Ireland and for Northern England today, there could be a few spots of drizzle around. It's a murky start. There's lots of low cloud, but it should stay largely dry and it will feel a bit breezier than it did yesterday. For Northern Scotland, it's windier. Gusts of wind of around 40 to 50 miles an hour, especially across the Northern Isles. We'll see some more rain move across northwest Scotland too. Longer spells of rain for Shetland. And temperature-wise, well, we'll be between 13 and 16 degrees Celsius for most of us. But we could get to 16, 17 degrees across parts of Aberdeenshire, maybe in the shelter of the wind and also given any sunny spells. Now tonight, a lot of cloud around, some spooky mist and fog developing too, but we'll keep the heavier rain across northern Scotland. That's the forecast.
Thanks very much, Elizabeth. The newspapers are dominated by one big story. Unsurprisingly, it is the budget. The Times describes it as the biggest rise in tax and borrowing for a generation and highlights that it takes the tax burden to the highest level on record. It also homes in on the rise in borrowing, which it says is the biggest surge outside a crisis for more than 30 years. In its editorial, it says there's much to criticise about the budget, mainly because the Chancellor had promised growth, and the OBR's verdict is that this budget won't in the long run deliver it. That's the Office for Budget Responsibility, describing her budget speech as less 2024 and more 1974, and resembling the Labour budgets the country endured before Ms Reeves was born. The Times says it has jettisoned the exciting promise of the election to revert to, in its words, old-fashioned tax and spend.
Nightmare on Downing Street is the Daily Telegraph's headline verdict, saying Ms Reeves has crushed hopes of higher growth with a record tax raid that will damage land living standards. On this Halloween morning, the cartoon shows her budget box as a pumpkin while she wears a necklace of skulls. The paper argues that millions of workers will now face 2 years of stagnant pay as the tax raid squeezes businesses and staff. It says the budget was characterised by mendacity because the Chancellor broke her election promises. The Sun continues the seasonally scary theme, calling the budget a Halloween horror show, complete with a picture of the Chancellor as a pumpkin. But it praises the freeze on fuel duty, which it calls a big victory after it had campaigned on the issue. At least she kept it down at the pumpkins, it quips.
Groan. As far as the Daily Mail is concerned, the budget is a £40 billion tax bombshell for Britain's strivers, prompting the country's growth prospects to take, in its words, a dive. It accuses the Chancellor of using a sleight of hand to pilfer people's wallets.
The Guardian greets the first Labour budget in 14 years with the headline Return of Tax and Spend. It describes the measures as a massive package. The Chancellor, it suggests, is gambling on voters being happy that the government is raising money to try and patch up, in the paper's words, Britain's crumbling public services, notably health and schools.
And for the Daily Mirror, it was an historic budget, raising record cash to transform the NHS and schools and undoing 14 years of Tory negligence. It says the decision to raise taxes to fund schools and hospitals won't be universally welcomed, but is categorically right.
Away from the budget, according to the Times, Scotland's National Reading Charity has come under fire for altering the lyrics of what it calls beloved children's songs to remove references to alcohol and to violence. In one example, the Scottish Book Trust changed the title of What Should We Do With a Drunken Sailor to What Should We Do With a Grumpy Pirate. The Scottish Conservative MSP, Stephen Kerr, who first reported the changes to the Telegraph, called them ridiculous and accused the organisation of serving up what he called politically acceptable gruel. The Trust defended itself, saying it was common for songs to evolve.
It's 12 minutes past six. The whole of Spain weeps for you. We will not abandon you. The words of the Spanish Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, as his country comes to terms with terrible flash flooding. At least 95 people have lost their lives, most of them in Valencia, on the country's eastern Mediterranean coast. Our correspondent, Nicky Schiller, is there. I spoke to him a short while ago.
I am in the La Torre area of Valencia, which is about 5 kilometres from the centre. And all around me, there is thick mud and cars piled up, one on top of each other. There's debris on the roads. It's eerily quiet because this area is cut off. So the bridge that you get to this area, we've had to walk across, and there are police patrols coming through this area. And as I talk to you now, people are walking into the city, and I look ahead of me and it's complete darkness because there have been power cuts in this area. And we've been talking to some of the locals who say a little bit further on, it is even worse than what I can see. So this is the scene that is replicated across this Valencia region, where the water came flooding down, people describing it like a tsunami. Certainly, I've spoken to some local people in the city and they said it was 2 metres tall and deep, and that has just crashed through this whole area. And you're just seeing an absolute mess in the streets around me.
We're very much in a discovery phase of these floods rather than beginning the clear up.
So I think it'll be two separate different things, Johnny. So basically in those areas that have been really badly hit and cut off, then we are still talking about rescue, trying to get in and find people. Whereas here in the city, I think it will be much more of a clear up because the waters have gone and it is now the mud and debris and the just so many. I can't tell you how many cars I've just seen piled up and windows broken. And that is what is going to have to be cleared up. And already the insurers are talking about how this could be the costliest natural disaster in Spain. And just looking at the amount just of the cars, you can see why that would be the case.
Nikki Sylla, thank you very much indeed.
It's 14 minutes past six now. Joe Biden may not be running for election in next week's presidential contest, but his comment, which appeared to compare Donald Trump's supporters with garbage, is now dominating campaigning. I've been speaking to our North America correspondent, Rowan Bridge, about the fallout from President Biden's comments.
Donald Trump clearly sees this as a wedge issue that he can make hay out of. And Donald Trump is a showman. You know, this is a guy who made his name really on TV, on reality TV, on The Apprentice, and so knows what makes for good television. And so what you saw was him turning up at his rally today in the branded sort of refuse truck with Trump on the side of it. And then he went on to do his rally wearing this high-vis tabard and saying at the start of it, you know, 250 Americans are not garbage. This is clearly something he thinks is cutting through for them, trying to make hay out of Joe Biden's comments, where he appeared to criticise Trump supporters, though the White House has made it clear that Joe Biden's reference was to Tony Hinchcliffe, the comedian who made the comment, rather than Trump supporters in general.
And Kamala Harris has felt that she has to distance herself.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're always in a difficult position when you're the vice president running for the top job, because you want to set out your own path, but you can't be seen to sort of overtly criticise your boss, or you don't want to. So she's having to tread a fine line on this issue. So she said she would strongly disagree with the criticism of anyone based on who they voted for. So she's kind of making the point to say, you know, I am open to all people, without directly taking a jab at Joe Biden directly over what he said.
It's easy for us to get distracted by these headline-grabbing rows. It's the fundamental that move voters in the end, isn't it? And perhaps the economy will be seen as central to this election campaign.
Yeah, I mean, I think the economy and the cost of living is a massive issue in this campaign. I mean, if you go, and often is, you know, if you go back as far as 1992, it was James Carville, when he was involved in Bill Clinton's election campaign, who had that favourite slogan, "It's the economy, stupid." And it's the same thing here. And I think Kamala Harris recognised in her appearance at a rally this evening that the economy is something that she has to address directly. And it was interesting to note that she said, at the top of my list is bringing down the cost of living. That will be my focus every single day, because she knows that inflation is hurting voters, and that is something that they are going to consider when they come to the ballot box.
Rowan Bridge, our North America correspondent. Thank you.
Well, the government spent weeks prior to the budget trying to keep things calm on the financial markets. There were still jitters, particularly on the bond market, following the Chancellor's speech. Will Bain has more on that and the rest of business reaction.
Morning, Johnny. Morning, Nick. Yeah, it was initially pre the speech, with all that information that had been out in the papers around changes to the debt rules and things like that explained to the market. The bond market seemed pretty calm. That changed through the afternoon and then calm down a little bit again later on. Ella Hoja, head of fixed income at Newton Investment Management, is with us this morning. Ella, morning.
Good morning.
Why the sort of ride that the bond market in particular went on yesterday?
Initial reaction was, no surprises, given that the fiscal rule changes had been flagged last week and the bond market had been readjusting its rate expectations on the back of that. But then, of course, we got the OBR announcement following that, and that created a bit more pressure. So yields went up, so borrowing costs went up slightly by the end of the day. So quite a bit of volatility on the day.
So where are we this morning?
We haven't opened yet in gilts. I would say sterling's been trading more stable, so that's a positive sign. And also the equity market did better. So UK equities did better yesterday, particularly medium and small sized equities. So that's on the margin, a more encouraging sign. And I would say sort of no major disruption on bond yields expected. I think we've digested some of the news. So for the Chancellor, probably as good as you would have hoped, given how much of a whopper this budget was.
What potential impact could there be on longer term kind of borrowing rates, things like mortgage rates, for us though, with that bond rate still staying relatively high, the yield relatively high?
So compared to other markets, so gilts are demanding a higher premium. So investors like ourselves are looking for higher yields in terms of investing longer maturity in the UK, or you know, if it comes to lending to the UK government, if you like. But broadly speaking, you know, think borrowing costs are coming down relative to where we were, say, last year, right? So, and that's because inflation has been coming down. So net-net, after this budget, perhaps slightly higher inflation than had been anticipated before, potentially higher growth, at least over the next couple of years. So net-net more supportive of the currency, and for mortgages, maybe a little bit higher borrowing costs relative to where we were prior to the budget.
And you mentioned the share markets, FTSE 250 got a lot more UK-focused companies than the FTSE 100, hasn't it? That responded pretty well yesterday. And the AIM market was of those really sort of small emerging companies also performed well, because it didn't quite get hit as much with potential changes to inheritance tax as people feared. Just explain that one out.
Yes, I mean, as I said, we'd had some time to adjust to this new reality because a lot of this was leaked, as we know, before. But there is this element, if you want to be a bit more upbeat about the budget, as there's a huge investment element to it. And the UK has been lagging G7 economies on investment for over five decades. So we're very much at the bottom of that range. So some investments should be good for the economy. Of course, it's a bit of a gamble on growth over the longer term. But for at least for equities, that should be a positive and explain some of the reaction function as well that we saw yesterday.
Ella, thanks so much for your time. Ella Hoja, the head of fixed income at Newton Investment Management. Well, something else that was well trailed, but the Chancellor did indeed move ahead with an employer's national insurance contribution hike from 13.8% to 15%. Crucially, though, was a change to the thresholds, with employers now paying national insurance on salaries above £5,000 rather than those above £9,100. The government says the move will raise an additional £25 billion a year, by far the biggest tax-raising measure in the budget. Yesterday on the programme, we heard from Fiona Eastwood, Chief Operating Officer at the events firm Merlin Entertainment, owner of the likes of Legoland and Alton Towers. She told us about the increased costs and what they could add up to in terms of pressure on the hospitality sector.
We did a recent survey this month, and with all of our members, 29% have reduced profits this year, 12% have only broke even, and 18% as operating at a loss. So that means 30% of businesses that are either breaking even or operating at a loss could go under, given these increasing costs.
Louise McLean is the director of the Signature Group. They own multiple pubs and bars across Scotland. Louise is also a spokesperson for the Scottish Hospitality Group. Morning.
Good morning.
What was the budget like for hospitality then in the end? There'd been a lot of build-up, as we said. What were the realities?
The reality was, why is it always us that seem to have the impact? I think we all knew that employers NI was going up, and we all knew that national living wage was going to increase. But the drop in the threshold was a bit of a kicker that we didn't see coming. The total impact for our business in the course of yesterday afternoon is a £1.7 million increase in staff costs.
And presumably, you hadn't particularly planned for that.
No, and we don't make that in profit. So yesterday's budget made us a loss-making enterprise. So we are going to have to make some changes come April to tip us back into profit.
When you say changes, what does that mean? Letting people go? Closing premises?
Definitely not. That will not help anything. What we will need to do is pass a lot of this on to the consumer, which is not what any of us wanted to do. And we worked at such tight margins in hospitality, like a lot of other sectors. But unfortunately, this will mean increased prices in every venue across the country.
Right. And how soon would people expect to, I don't know, be paying more for their meal, be paying more for their drink in a venue?
April the 1st. We'll try to do nothing, because we are very transparent about the margins we make. But when our costs go up so significantly, as they have done with yesterday's announcement, we will have to pass that on to the consumer. And the question is, how much more can the consumer take? How much more before they say, do you know, going out's a luxury, we're not going to do it so much? Or, do you know, let's just stay in. Let's look at cheaper alternatives. Because we do support local. We're very proud of the standards that we hold ourselves to in our sector. And we don't want to compromise those standards. We don't want to change the business we are. But we also cannot fall into the red.
Louise, thanks so much for your time this morning. Louise McLean, the director of the Signature Group, owns a number of pubs across Scotland, also a spokesperson for the Scottish Hospitality Group. The Chancellor committed £5 billion of investment yesterday to house building, including a £500 million boost to the current affordable homes budget. There were also changes around stamp duty, with the surcharge paid on second home purchases in England and Northern Ireland set to rise from 3% to 5%. And the threshold at which first-time buyers pay that tax was also changed, with the relief previously on homes up to £425,000 now set to reduce to £300,000 next year. Eleanor Dealey, Joint Managing Director of the Dealey Group, Coventry-based house builder and contractors with us. Eleanor, morning.
Good morning.
Same question, I guess, I asked to Louise. There was a lot in there again, especially for your sector. What was your sort of big takeaway?
For us within the construction and housing industry, a lot of what came yesterday was a reaffirmation of previous announcements, as you say, the £5 billion and the £500 million. There were two new things which were helpful from a construction perspective, and that was the £5 billion to support SME house builders and build to rent. Since the 1980s, 80% of SME house builders have just disappeared because house building has become so difficult to deliver viability. And build to rent is going to be a really important element of delivering the 1.5 million houses that the government are looking to do. The second thing that was helpful from a construction perspective was the recognition that actually we're going to need to have about 900,000 new workers come into the industry to deliver. But the 40 million that was promised for foundation and shorter apprenticeships works out as 45 per person. That's not going to be enough to deliver the workers, to deliver the homes the government are looking to do.
Right, so more to do there. And also the pace of some of this change as well.
Absolutely, because a lot of what was announced, in fact, won't be coming in until spring. And that means that we're treading water for another 6 months, because while the affordable homes programme is increased by 500 million, that's only for the first year. There's no clarity or certainty over what's going to happen in the medium term.
I suppose the idea is that it sort of jump starts the sector, though.
There are some great words and some the 500 million certainly is helpful, but in order to jumpstart the sector, what we actually need is more market stimulus to stimulate first-time buyers or even last-time buyers. Mm. We need more around supported housing.
And on that, what about that change in terms of the stamp duty relief for first-time buyers, the reduction there?
Yes, I mean, I think it's not helpful. What it's anticipated is that you'll have 130,000 homes come to the market. You'll end up with less houses being rented. So in effect, what will happen is that rental prices are likely to increase because of that.
Eleanor, you and the team at the Dealey Group were one of those companies that signed that letter, people might remember, back in the summer ahead of the general election, endorsing, I guess, Labour's economic plan, saying it was time for a change and that you thought they had some of the right ideas for boosting business and boosting growth. After you sat through a first Labour budget, do you still hold that view?
I still hold the view that growth is essential for all of us to deliver what we want to. I am disappointed in terms of the narrative and disappointed in terms of the detail about actually delivering the objectives. We've heard a great deal about the objectives, which I do believe are the right objectives of growth, and construction can help that. But actually, we need detail on how that's going to be delivered, and that currently is missing.
When you talk about narrative, what's missing in the narrative, or what's not, what's in the narrative that you don't like?
the narrative has moved from being one focusing on growth and investment to one being around the level of tax, obviously, that businesses are now having to take on, and the narrative about it being the worst time ever in terms of some of those burdens, while actually what we need to be focusing on is growing the economy and growing GDP. And obviously the warnings on growth from the OBR are not helpful.
Eleanor Dealey, Joint Managing Director of the Dealey Group, thanks so much for your time.
Well, thank you. It's coming up to 29 minutes past six now. I went to bed early, Mike. I didn't watch because I sort of knew it would be another disappointing night for my team.
You were worried it was going to be the nightmare before Halloween. But it didn't turn out to be, Nick. Who needs a permanent manager? Turns out Manchester United don't, at the moment at least. They may still be awaiting the arrival of Ruben Amorim as their new permanent head coach. But Manchester United still booked their place in the quarterfinals of the League Cup last night after an entertaining 5-2 victory over Leicester City at Old Trafford. Former striker Ruud van Nistelrooy is in temporary charge at United. But how long does he expect to do that job for?
I think it's clear that it will be for the short term. For me, today was the most important day, obviously, after what happened in such a short notice. We had to really be getting things going. That worked today to get to the quarterfinals, and that's credit to the players. They were fantastic today. And for me, focus is on, for now, is on Sunday, Chelsea. And further, I don't really look.
So an impressive performance and result for United, who will now face Tottenham in the quarterfinals after they produced a shock in North London.
And that's it. Manchester City are out of the Carabao Cup. Tottenham Hotspur have beaten them by 2-1, an embrace between Pep Guardiola and Ange Postecoglou.
I believe every time I wake up in the morning that we can bring success to the club as well. I'm here, whether it's in this competition or any other competition. So, but as you said, you know, we're in the final eight now, and we're giving ourselves a chance to progress.
Yes, that man, Ange Postecoglou, steering his side Tottenham to a 2-1 victory over the Premier League leaders Manchester City last night at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. Elsewhere, the League Cup holders Liverpool beat Brighton by 3-2. Newcastle beat Chelsea 2-0. Crystal Palace knocked Aston Villa out by 2-1, whilst Arsenal were 3-0 winners at Preston. So the quarter-final draw for the League Cup in full. Tottenham will play Manchester United. Arsenal face Crystal Palace. Newcastle host Brentford, while Southampton will play Liverpool. And those ties to take place on the sixth week beginning the 16th of December. Meanwhile, there was a full round of fixtures in the Scottish Premiership last night, with the big headline being defeat for Rangers at second-placed Aberdeen. The result leaves Rangers in third, 9 points behind Aberdeen and the leaders Celtic, who are both unbeaten. So does under-fire manager Philippe Clement believe he can turn things around?
I'm very confident of that. I believe a lot in this young group. Of course, they need to learn things, they need to become better, but I believe a lot in the potential.
Elsewhere, Celtic beat Dundee 2-0 last night, and there were also wins for Motherwell, Kilmarnock and St Mirren. Finally, away from the football, England's cricketers begin their three-match one-day series at the West Indies later today. Liam Livingstone will captain the side in the absence of regular skipper Joss Butler for the first match, which takes place in Antigua at 6 p.m. UK time.
Thanks very much, Mike. It is 29 minutes to 7. Here's John Wilson to tell us about what's coming up later this morning.
One of our most popular and prolific actors, Bill Nye, looks back to his early career at the Liverpool Everyman Theatre in the 1970s alongside the likes of Jonathan Pryce and Julie Walters at a time of campaigning theatre and radical politics.
The company was jam-packed with people who were overburdened with talent, you know, and I felt very, very, very insecure. It was also a very politically engaged theatre. Right. And by the time I got there, I'd arranged not to know what left and right meant. And it got too late to ask anyone. I was just a mess.
Bill Nye talking to me, John Wilson, on This Cultural Life at 11 o'clock this morning on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Time now is 28 minutes to 7. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Johnny Diamond and Nick Robinson. And Caroline Nichols has a summary of the news.
The International Monetary Fund has welcomed the measures announced by the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, in her budget yesterday. She unveiled tax increases worth about £40 billion in order to increase investment and spending on public services. The global watchdog for monetary issues said it supported the sustainable methods for raising revenue to ease the pressure on public services. It also backed the reforms to rules constraining borrowing. The Spanish government has declared 3 days of national mourning after at least 95 people were killed by flooding yesterday. A year's worth of rain fell within 8 hours in the region of Valencia. The floods blocked roads with mud, debris and cars. Emergency teams are searching for missing people. Hundreds of soldiers have been sent to help with the recovery effort. New analysis suggests that human-caused climate change has made the 10 deadliest extreme weather events of the last 20 years more intense and more likely. According to the researchers, the storms, heat waves and floods killed at least 570,000 people across Europe, Africa and Asia. The World Weather Attribution Team at Imperial College London developed a method that allows them to discern the fingerprint of climate change in individual weather events. North Korea has fired an intercontinental ballistic missile, which flew for nearly an hour and a half before falling into the sea near Japan. The North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, said it was a warning to enemies who threatened his country's security. The United States called it a breach of UN resolutions. Protection zones around abortion clinics in England and Wales come into force today. It'll be illegal to protest within 150 metres of a centre or to try to influence someone's decision to use their services. Anyone handing out leaflets, obstructing clinicians or blocking those using a clinic could face an unlimited fine. But silent prayer won't be automatically banned in the zones. The same rules are already in place in Scotland and Northern Ireland.
Caroline, thank you very much indeed. It's now 26 minutes to 7. It's often said, at least by those of us paid to study budgets, that you shouldn't judge them on the day they're delivered. You should wait to see how they look on the morning after and indeed in the days ahead as people study the small print and see how the markets and politics and the public react to them all. Well, one of those now paid to study them in the way I used to be is our chief political correspondent, Henry Zeffman. I'm not sure you need to wait, do you, Henry? The stark facts are staring us in the face.
I think the thing with this budget, Nick, is that people were judging it in the weeks and days in advance of the budget, let alone on the day, because we knew so much about what was going to be in it. But I think the knowledge beforehand of what was going to be in it could obscure what a big deal this package of measures is. It was always intrinsically going to be a big budget just by mere fact that it was Rachel Reeves's first budget, but also the first Labour budget for 14 years. But it absolutely does feel like the first Labour budget in 14 years in the sense that just as George Osborne's first Conservative budget in 2010 put the British economy onto a different course, so too does this budget, and it is a higher tax, higher spend course. But there is a question, I think, about consistency, or as some would have it, honesty there. We knew in advance there'd be questions about the honesty of increasing national insurance, and that's been well ventilated, the question about whether that's consistent with the manifesto or not, and the government is adamant that it is. But I think in the sort of, there's a question now of spirit. Rachel Reeves, before the election, said, I don't have plans to be a big tax-raising chancellor. Keir Starmer said Labour would not be reaching for the big government chequebook, his phrase, to fund public services if they won the general election. Now, the Labour Party, the Labour government, says, and Rachel Reeves argued yesterday, that having to change their approach slightly is simply because they didn't realise how parlous a state the public finances and public services were in. But their critics will argue, they argued yesterday and they'll argue it for years to come, this is just an ideological predisposition of the Labour Party to high tax and high spend.
The Chancellor, and she's been doing interviews already, and we'll hear from her at 8:10, is saying effectively, look, I really didn't have any choice, and don't worry, it's a one-off. She can't be sure, though, can she?
Well, that's one of the striking things, isn't it, about the budget spending plans, is that they start to taper off a little towards the end of the five-year period. And if you ask the government, that's where they say the reform comes in, the reform of public services, which they promised repeatedly in the run-up to the general election. So a lot of the spending in the first couple of years is going on the NHS, a big boost in spending for the NHS. But early next year, we will be getting Wes Streeting's 10-year reform plans for the NHS. Clearly, the government needs, on their own terms, to find a way to deliver better public services in a reformed way, requiring less money. Otherwise, potentially, the temptation, as it has been for governments of all political stripes over the decades, the temptation may well be to boost public spending in the run-up to a general election.
Henry, thank you very much indeed. Let's turn now to Paul Johnson, who has already given us plenty of analysis here on Radio 4. Paul Johnson, of course, director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies. But often, Paul, you come on the next day after a budget and say, ah, I've found this. Is it one of those budgets or is it just the big headlines that we've still all got to get used to?
Well, there's certainly some big headlines there. I think for me, the most striking thing about this budget is that the spending plans don't quite look like the generous ones they immediately appear to be. So we've got a lot of additional spending this year. I mean, remarkable amount of additional spending this year and a fair bit next year. But the Chancellor has rather taken a leaf out of her predecessor's playbook in terms of the years after that. So if you look from 2026, 27 onwards, spending is growing very, very slowly in these figures to a degree that I would describe as almost as implausibly slowly as what Jeremy Hunt was suggesting last year. And she needed to do that, just as Jeremy Hunt needed to do that, to make her fiscal arithmetic balance. Now, it's possible, she argued, and that we'll be in a world in which spending rises so much this year and next that no more money will be needed for the next 3 years of this parliament. But I bet an awful lot that that's not what's going to happen, particularly given the problems that Chancellor has clearly had selling this to her cabinet colleagues this time round. I suspect we'll end up with even more spending, possibly considerably more spending than is currently planned. And that will probably mean, well, unless she gets lucky with growth, more tax rises to come next year or the year after.
Gets lucky with growth. That's the really striking statistics in the official forecast, isn't it? A short-term boost to growth and then growth that in historic terms, pre the pandemic, pre the big banking crisis of 2008, looks pretty weak.
Yeah, the growth forecasts here are pretty awful. As you say, there's a bit of an increase in the first year or two because the OBR says, look, the government chucking loads of money at the economy, that's going to help growth. But go 2 or 3 years out, then first of all, obviously there's a great big tax rise in there, which is going to reduce people's disposable incomes. And the OBR says the increases in borrowing and so on are going to increase interest rates and inflation. And the consequence of all of this is that the OBR has also downgraded its projections of household income growth. It now thinks this parliament will be the worst in history, household income growth, apart from the last parliament, which is not going to be a recipe for a happy electorate in 4 years' time.
Paul, spell that out, would you? Because traditionally, we broadcasters, you know, we say, what does this mean for ordinary people? And there'll be lots of people who looked at the budget and go, well, phew, you know, my petrol duty's not going up and they're not going to freeze the thresholds on tax. There's all sorts of things. In other words, the traditional budget measures are not going worse. And yet you're telling them their disposable income is going to get worse and they are really paying this big tax increase. How, if it's not appearing on their tax slip?
Yeah, well, certainly most of the impact of this national insurance rise will appear in lower wages than would otherwise have happened. So it's not very clear. It certainly won't appear on the pay slip. But, you know, just as if I go and buy a washing machine or whatever, there's VAT on that washing machine. I don't write the check for the VAT, the retailer does, but I'm still effectively paying that VAT. In the same way, my employer might write the check for the national insurance contributions, but I'll effectively be paying for most of it because it'll cost my employer more to employ me, and so my wages will be less than they otherwise would have been.
That is clear. Paul Johnson, thank you very much again, indeed, again, for helping us see through the fog.
It is 18 minutes to 7, and in a Middle East conflict that seems to only go one way, worse, there may be some good news. Talk is of a ceasefire in Lebanon. Israel has been bombing across the country, attacking what it says is the leadership of Hezbollah, the Iranian-backed group classed as a terrorist organisation by the UK, the EU and the US. And Israel's troops have been operating on the ground in the south of Lebanon, which Hezbollah has used to bombard the north of Israel. But Lebanon's prime minister has suggested that a ceasefire might be on the cards. Yolande Nell is our Middle East correspondent. Morning, Yolande. The PM, I think, voiced cautious optimism, the Lebanese prime minister.
That's right. Jim McCarthy was speaking in a TV interview and he said he hoped to see a ceasefire in the coming days after meeting a US envoy and said a deal was possible ahead of the US elections. We are expecting the US envoys Amos Hochstein and Brett McCurk back to meet the Israelis today. And there has been a lot of coverage in the Israeli media in recent weeks suggesting that there is movement getting closer to a political settlement between Israel and Lebanon. Reports that there's, you know, draft proposals that on the table. One of them sort of leaked to the Israeli Public Service broadcaster. And looking through that, you know, it does seem to meet some of Israel's demands, certainly in terms of kind of reinforcing the UN Security Council Resolution 1701 that we've been hearing so much about in recent days, that would push Hezbollah, an armed presence of Hezbollah, north of the Litani River line in Lebanon, that would see a large deployment of Lebanese army forces along the border with Israel, and have some kind of international supervision and enforcement mechanism. But the parts which are difficult that are being discussed, it seems, certainly for Hezbollah, for Lebanon to agree to, are kind of, you know, Israel seeking guarantees that it can still have freedom of movement to remove threats from Hezbollah, particularly to stop it from rearming. And there are reports of a sort of draft side letter between Israel and the US affirming Israel's right to self-defense.
Yolan, thank you very much indeed. Yolan Nell, our Middle East correspondent.
16 minutes to 7, let's take a look at the front pages. They are, of course, all dominated by the budget and also by a photograph of the first woman chancellor, let's not forget, to deliver a budget ever. First in 800 years of the history of that office of Chancellor of the Exchequer. Now, she is smiling, but the headlines don't reflect that sort of view. Reeves unveils £40 billion budget tax rise is the FT. It's called a tax gamble by the AI. A record tax burden, says The Times, The Express, Halloween Horror Show, The Telegraph and other papers pick up that Halloween theme, Nightmare on Downing Street, with a cartoon rather than a photograph on the front cover in which the red box is turned into a pumpkin with a rather scary smile on its face.
Yeah, more pumpkins on the front page of The Sun, or at least one pumpkin. Again, the whole of Rachel Reeves's head turned into a pumpkin. And the headline, at least she kept it down at the pumpkins, which is a clever pun for the morning, about The Sun's campaign to make sure that fuel duty does not rise. The Mirror, spending power, somewhat more positive there. Smiling Rachel Reeves there. Record cash to transform NHS and schools. £40 billion tax hikers, tough choices made. The Guardian, return of tax and spend. Less positive, hardly surprising, in the Mail. Reeves's £40 billion tax bombshell for Britain's strivers.
Often takes Matt, the cartoonist of The Telegraph, to sum things up. There's a nice shot of what looks like a company boss behind his big desk saying, "Now I've seen the budget details, I no longer think uncertainty is the worst thing for business." It is now 14 minutes to 7. Let's turn to yesterday in Parliament and that budget delivered to a packed House of Commons. Here with a report on yesterday in Parliament is our correspondent, Alicia McCarthy.
Sizeable, substantial, huge or hefty, whichever word you chose, in the run-up to the budget, economic experts were predicting that Rachel Reeves' announcements were going to be big. And they weren't wrong.
This budget raises taxes by £40 billion.
That stark figure came as Rachel Reeves delivered the first Labour budget in 14 years and the first ever from a female Chancellor. And it wasn't short of ambition.
An economy that is growing, creating wealth and opportunity for all. Because that is the only way to improve living standards. Yeah. And the only way to drive economic growth is to invest, invest, invest. Yeah.
There were few surprises. Her plans had been well trailed in advance. Tax rises, cash for public services, more borrowing and more investment. All of it, she argued, needed to repair the damage left by the Conservatives.
A black hole in the public finances. Public services on their knees. A decade of low growth and the worst Parliament on record for living standards. Yeah.
And so she confirmed changes to some capital gains and inheritance taxes, hikes for tobacco, vapes and most booze, and putting VAT on private school fees. But the biggest revenue raiser, a rise in employers' national insurance contributions.
This will raise £25 billion per year by the end of the forecast period. I know that this is a difficult choice. I do not take this decision lightly.
As to where the money would go, there'd be more for schools, roads, transport and housing in England, and a boost for defence. And central to her package, a £22 billion boost for England's NHS, with more on top for building repairs and increasing capacity. Rishi Sunak, in probably his last Commons appearance as Conservative Party leader, said the poorest pensioners were being squeezed while welfare spending was out of control. And despite what Labour had promised working people, a spree of tax rises.
National insurance up. Capital gains tax up. Inheritance tax up. Energy taxes up. Business rates up. First time buyer stamp duty up. Pensions tax up. They have fiddled the figures.
Well, that got MPs going, and Rishi Sunak attacked the Chancellor's claim that her economic inheritance had left her with few choices. He reckoned the Tories had handed on lower borrowing and debt than many other big countries.
Labour's claims about their inheritance are purely ludicrous. Yeah. These are her choices. Yeah. So stop blaming everyone else and take responsibility for them.
Well, after all that excited hollering, a lot of MPs left the chamber, leaving the Liberal Democrat leader, Sir Ed Davey, to make his points in a slightly calmer atmosphere. His verdict? The government wouldn't be able to fix the NHS if it ignored social care.
We all know how bad it is. Hundreds of thousands of people waiting for care, many stranded in hospital beds because the care isn't in place for them to leave hospital. That's bad for them, it's bad for their loved ones, and bad for the NHS. I'm afraid today's announcement on social care just won't touch the sides. It's only a standstill in a crisis.
The SNP's Dave Dugan reckoned the budget was just more austerity.
A Hobson's choice for Scotland in a broken Brexit Britain where things can only get worse. 900,000 Scottish pensioners will have watched today in the vain hope that the Chancellor would have U-turned on her winter fuel payment cut. Well, she finished that hope today.
Reform UK's Nigel Farage was equally gloomy.
We are in much deeper trouble than anybody on either front bench dares to admit. It's a reality we should all face. And I have to say that, for a Labour Party that couldn't define what a woman was, couldn't define what a working person was, well, after today, I'm pretty convinced they can't define what economic growth is.
But Labour MP and economist Jeevan Sander exuded optimism.
Slowly, surely, certainly, as we invest in this nation, we will create a more prosperous Britain.
The veteran Conservative Sir Desmond Swain reckoned the government was trying to talk up growth, while at the same time saying the Tories had left everything broken.
Madam Deputy Speaker, a piece of Swahili wisdom. Huwezi kafukuza suwala walili. You can't chase two antelope. And that is exactly what the government has been doing since it was elected.
Well, debate on the budget, presumably in English, will continue until the middle of next week.
That was Alicia McCarthy. You can hear more on events in yesterday in Parliament at 9 o'clock on Radio 4 Extra and on digital radio. Much of this morning's programme will be devoted to the budget. We'll be speaking to Shadow Chancellor Jeremy Hunt after 7 o'clock and the Chancellor Rachel Reeves after 8. Later on in the morning, we'll be putting your thoughts and questions to our business editor and to the FT's personal finance editor. So we would like to hear from you. Send your questions on WhatsApp on 0330 123 4346 or email today at bbc.co.uk. But before that, some reaction to what everyone acknowledges was a big, bold budget. First, Stephen Flynn, leader of the Scottish National Party at Westminster. Among his concerns, the size of the tax rises being put in place to fund new spending.
In the SNP, we've been arguing for greater investment in our public services for a significant period of time. Indeed, we ran into the general election shouting from the rooftops about that. And the Labour Party have finally appeared to have agreed with us in that context. But what worries us, and I think what will be worrying most people out in the real world, is how Labour are choosing to fund some of the investment that they're putting in place. Now, the sheer scale of the rises that they're doing on national insurance employer contributions is eye-watering, and the impact that could ultimately have, in all likelihood will have, on growth based upon what the OBR have outlined is huge. The wider economic picture for the UK is still one of anemic growth. Indeed, I think it flatlines and then starts falling towards the end of the five-year cycle. So Labour have promised big. They promised transformative economic growth, and that's simply not what we are seeing. So the stability of being able to provide the huge level of investment that the economy requires is perhaps going to be undermined by their very own actions.
That was Stephen Flint of the SNP. Sir Ed Davey is leader of the Liberal Democrats. He joins us now. He's in the studio. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, John.
You've welcomed the new money for the NHS, but you've criticised the rise in national insurance that funds it. How would you find the money?
Yeah, well, we certainly have welcomed the NHS money, and we do accept that there was a economic mismanagement. The Conservatives left a big black hole to be filled. The question is how you went about that. And in the general election, we talked about how we would have done that. So we talked about asking the big banks to pay more, reversing the tax cuts the Conservatives had given to the big banks. We talked about asking the social media giants to pay more. We talked about a different reform of capital gains tax, which would have been actually fairer for small investors, but actually raised more from the very wealthy. So we had a different tax package, and I'm really worried about the tax proposals they put forward. I think it is going to hit small business, and I'm really worried about the inheritance tax changes for family farms, small family farms. So we have some real worries about how they're raising this money, as well as you heard in that clip from yesterday in Parliament, what they're doing on care. That is a real worry, because what we've been saying for quite a few years now is if you're going to sort out the NHS, you have to sort out social care. And there was almost nothing on that in the budget. So I'm afraid, yes, it's good to see more money in the NHS, of course, but I'm not sure if that's going to work unless you sort out social care too.
You mentioned the inheritance tax on farms, and the former leader, Tim Farron, was pretty vociferous about this yesterday. What is your key concern there? Because I'm fairly sure the Labour government sort of says this really isn't going to affect that many people.
I just think they're wrong. There's about 50% of farms are worth more than 1.5 million. So that, you know, half of our farms could be hit by this. And that's going to have a massive damage to our agriculture and to families and communities in our rural areas.
They are assets, aren't they? I mean, why shouldn't they be taxed?
The point is, if you're investing in your countryside, in your farms, you need it through generations. And that's been accepted across parties for many years now. And I'm really worried about our rural communities and our farmers as a result of this budget. Let's remember that they've already hit by the Conservatives, losing markets in Europe, the trade deals that have damaged them so badly, the failure to support to reform the subsidy schemes as we came out of Europe. So they've already been hit so many times. And of course, the bad weather. So the farmers are on their knees in many parts of our country. This is the worst news for them. So we're genuinely worried about that, as well as the impact on small businesses as well. And if I can come back to care providers, please. You know, the government have exempted the NHS from these rise in employers' national insurance contributions. But small care providers, who are about 98% of people providing care in care homes and in people's own homes, they're going to be hit by this big rise in national insurance contributions. And many of them will go to the wall. So this is really serious, because if you're seeing the care sector not invested, if you're seeing care providers probably leaving the market in some areas, that's going to undermine care, which will make the NHS problems even worse.
You have picked up an awful lot of new voters in new seats at the election, and that may have changed your priorities a little. Can I ask you about the VAT, so-called VAT raid on private schools? Will you vote in favour of that?
No, we'll vote against it.
Why is that?
Well, because we think a tax on education is the wrong thing to do, in principle, frankly. And we're really worried that this is very ill thought through, how it's going to affect small private schools who are looking after children and young people with special education needs, for example. So I think it's really poorly thought through. And that's why at the general election we put forward alternative ideas.
We will leave it there. Sir Ed Davey, thank you very much. Thanks for coming in.
And in about half an hour's time, we'll hear from the former Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, and the Chancellor herself at 8:10.
Was Anne Boleyn really a wicked queen?
People feared women who were smart.
Slay girl.
Exactly.
What about Rasputin? A miraculous mystic or a diehard deviant?
I think there's some bad stuff in there. I do weirdly respect him.
On Evil Genius, we're the judges of that. Join me, Russell Cain, and a host of comedians as we put more historical legends under scrutiny to find out if they're evil or genius. Evil Genius. Listen on BBC Sounds.
3 minutes to seven. Let's find out the budget day after weather. Elizabeth Rizzini's here.
Thanks, Johnny. Well, it's generally dry and it's settled for most of us. Some issues with mist and fog and plenty of low cloud, but it is mild for the time of year. It's quite a quiet spell of weather with no big changes in the forecast for the vast majority of us as we head through the weekend and indeed for much of next week as well. But quite the range of temperatures this morning. 14 degrees Celsius in Aberdeenshire, just 5-6 degrees Celsius across parts of Oxfordshire this morning. And here it's a foggy start to the day. We've got some dense patches of fog across Oxfordshire, Wiltshire, Somerset and generally across southern, central and eastern areas of the UK too. But here it is going to stay dry today. There'll be light winds and we'll see the early mist and fog lift and clear. Still quite a lot of low cloud around, especially out towards the west where there could be perhaps a few spots of drizzle. But some sunny spells too developing towards the lee of high ground in particular, especially across eastern coastal areas of England and also across northeast Scotland too. For Northern Ireland and for Northern England, could be a few spots of drizzle. It's quite a murky start. We'll be keeping those layers of cloud throughout the day, but it's breezier than it was yesterday and really quite windy across Northern Scotland. Now here we could see gusts of around 40 to 50 miles an hour, perhaps especially across the Northern Isles, and there will be rain moving into northwest Scotland. Longer spells of rain too for Shetland today. Generally, temperatures between 13 and 15 degrees Celsius, but we could get to 16 or 17 degrees, perhaps in parts of Aberdeenshire, a bit of added fern effect with those sunny spells. Now tonight, a lot of cloud around, a few breaks in the cloud for some, and we'll see some more mist and fog develop too. Quite spooky for any trick-or-treaters out there. Northern Scotland, again, some heavier rain and still gales here.
Elizabeth, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Today with Johnny Diamond and Nick Robinson.
It's 7 o'clock on Thursday, the 31st of October. The headlines this morning. The International Monetary Fund has welcomed yesterday's budget, describing the blockbuster tax rises as sustainable. The head of the OBR, the Office for Budget Responsibility, will be here just after the news. And Shadow Chancellor Jeremy Hunt will be with us at 7:30. Hundreds of soldiers have been deployed to help with the rescue effort in Spain, where flash floods have killed at least 95 people. North Korea has fired an intercontinental ballistic missile reported to have flown higher and for longer than previous tests. The BBC News is read by Caroline Nichols.
In a rare move, the International Monetary Fund has welcomed the measures announced by the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, in her budget yesterday. She unveiled tax increases worth about £40 billion in order to increase investment and spending on public services. Employers have voiced concern that they're bearing the brunt of the biggest tax rises in a generation, as our economics editor Faisal Islam reports.
The IMF welcomed yesterday's budget after one of the most consequential financial statements in recent history. The fund, which last week told BBC News that a boost to investment was much needed, backed sustainably raising revenue, i.e. tax rises, to help reduce the deficit, the addressing of urgent pressures in public spending, and some changes to the rules constraining borrowing. It was helpful support to the Chancellor after she decided on blockbuster increases in spending, taxation, borrowing and investment. A £76 billion a year rise in spending will take taxation to the highest level on record and spending closer to continental European levels. The UK is set for the highest sustained level of public investment in major capital projects for 50 years, which could, for example, help reinstate entirely a green energy promise dropped ahead of the election. Some businesses have expressed concern about shouldering the increase in the tax burden, with particular backlash on the application of inheritance tax to agricultural land. Interest rates facing government borrowing were up a touch yesterday, but markets were calm in general, with no repeat of the infamous mini-budget 2 years ago.
Rachel Reeves is out defending her budget this morning, while MPs will continue debating the measures in the Commons. There's particular scrutiny on the projected impact on economic growth, as our political correspondent Harry Farley reports.
Growth. That is this government's first priority. But the official forecasts for how much the economy will grow in 5 years' time have been downgraded as a result of this budget. Only after that, in the next 10 years, does the Independent Office for Budget Responsibility say that Rachel Reeves' investment measures will improve economic growth. Treasury officials insist they can defy the gloomy predictions with other changes to come, such as to the planning system. This budget sets the political framework for the next few years. Increases to taxes on businesses, capital gains, private schools and inheritance tax, all in an attempt to protect what Labour call working people. But the OBR makes clear most of the cost of Labour's increase to employers' national insurance will be passed on in lower wages and higher prices. Labour sources argue they can't turn everything around in one go.
Rachel Reeves has said she wouldn't want to repeat the tax increases from this budget in the future. But Paul Johnson from the Institute for Fiscal Studies told us further tax rises were likely because current plans for public spending were not realistic.
If you look from 2026-27 onwards, spending is growing very, very slowly in these figures to a degree that I would describe as almost as implausibly slowly, but I suspect we'll end up with more spending, possibly considerably more spending than is currently planned. And that will probably mean, unless you get lucky with growth, more tax rises to come next year or the year after.
Analysis of the budget by the Independent Resolution Foundation think tank suggests the outlook for living standards will remain weak over the next 4 to 5 years. The foundation, which focuses on those on low to middle incomes, says household disposable income per person is projected to grow in real terms by 0.5% a year on average across the parliament. However, the report acknowledges that public services will be better funded. Emergency teams in Spain are searching for those missing in the worst floods to hit the country in decades. At least 95 people have been killed, nearly all of them in the Valencia region, where a year's worth of rain fell in just 8 hours yesterday. Many roads are blocked by mud, debris and cars which had been swept away. Our Europe correspondent Bethany Bell sent this report from Valencia.
Spain is reeling from what's been described as one of the worst natural disasters in its recent history. Rescue workers are struggling to find the missing. Officials say it's not yet clear how many people are still unaccounted for. Some places can only be reached by helicopter. Hundreds of soldiers have been deployed to help with the rescue effort. Some local officials have complained that the flood warnings came too late. The Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, said those affected would not be abandoned. He extended his condolences to those who'd lost their loved ones. "The whole of Spain weeps with you," he said. 3 days of mourning have been declared.
The largest storm to hit Taiwan in nearly 30 years has made landfall, bringing winds of over 130 miles per hour and waves of up to 10 metres high. Thousands of people have already been evacuated ahead of super typhoon Kong Rei. All schools and offices are shut on the island. Domestic flights have been cancelled and the financial markets are closed. New analysis suggests that human-caused climate change has made the 10 deadliest extreme weather events of the last 20 years more intense and more likely. The killer storms, heat waves and floods left at least 570,000 people dead across Europe, Africa and Asia. The study has been released to mark the 10th anniversary of the World Weather Attribution Team at Imperial College London. Here's our climate editor, Justin Rowlatt.
The World Weather Attribution Team developed the science that allows researchers to discern the fingerprint of climate change in individual weather events. The deadliest of the last two decades was the drought that hit Somalia in 2011, which is thought to have killed more than a quarter of a million people. Today's study found it and storms, floods and heat waves were made both more likely and more extreme by a warming climate. The scientists said their findings underscored how dangerous extreme weather events had already become, with average global temperatures just 1.3 Celsius warmer than pre-industrial levels. The lead author, Dr. Freddy Otto, said the study should be an eye-opener for political leaders. If we keep burning oil, gas and coal, the suffering will continue, she warned.
North Korea has fired an intercontinental ballistic missile, which flew for nearly an hour and a half before falling into the sea near Japan. The North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, said it was a warning to enemies. Our correspondent, Shaima Khalil, reports from Tokyo.
Pyongyang said the intercontinental ballistic missile launch set a record exceeding their previous tests. The defense ministry in Tokyo said the ICBM was in the air for 1 hour and 26 minutes, longer than any other missile tested by the North. Defense officials in Seoul have said the test was intended to develop weapons that fire farther and higher, adding that it was possibly aimed at increasing the payload of the missile. South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff say the missile was launched from near Pyongyang and flew around more than 600 miles east before landing near Japan outside the country's territorial waters. Officials in Seoul said the missile might have used a newly developed solid fuel booster. They added that it was fired at a sharply high angle, which implies the missile could fly far into the Pacific towards the United States if fired at a lower angle.
Protection zones around abortion clinics in England and Wales have come into force, making it illegal to protest within 150 metres of them. Anyone breaking the law will face an unlimited fine. But silent prayer won't be banned within the zones. The government says police will deal with it on a case-by-case basis. The same zones are already in force in Scotland and Northern Ireland. The world's richest man, Elon Musk, has been told to appear in court in Pennsylvania later today after his political campaign group started giving away $1 million each day to a different voter in key states in the US presidential election. The Philadelphia district attorney has described the scheme as an illegal lottery. Mr. Musk is a high-profile backer of Donald Trump.
Caroline, thank you. It's coming up to 9 minutes past seven. So much had been briefed, so much had been leaked before the budget. It would be easy to overlook the scale of what was announced by the Chancellor yesterday. We're going to be talking to her in about an hour's time. This, I suspect, is one of a handful of budgets delivered since the war, which will still be being talked about for many years to come. Why? Because the huge hike in taxes on a scale rarely seen outside a national crisis. Because of a big increase in borrowing, made possible only by a change in the so-called fiscal rules. And because of a big short-term boost in public spending. But also, and perhaps most importantly, because the official forecast is not for it to produce a boost in economic growth, except in the very short term. And that is precisely what the government said was their top priority, and which, of course, ultimately pays for better public services and an improved standard of living. Well, let's talk to the man who produces those official forecasts. Richard Hughes is chair of the Office for Budget Responsibility. We often quote it was a body set up to stop politicians being in charge of what you are told about how the economy is performing. Richard, welcome back to the Today programme studio.
Morning, Nick.
Let's begin with growth. I imagine when the Chancellor got that forecast, it might have been pretty disappointing to her. Why isn't growth forecast to perform better than you have it?
So we've got an economy which is close to its full capacity. It was growing at 1.1% last year. We do think that the Chancellor's budget policies will, you know, because they're delivering an injection of cash into the economy, the government is spending more than it's bringing in additional revenue in this budget. That delivers a temporary boost to demand over the next few years. It raises the rate of GDP growth to 2% next year, about half a percentage point of that is due to budget policies, but that's a temporary effect on the demand side of the economy, and that falls back, that dissipates over the remainder of our forecast, and growth falls back to about 1.5% of GDP, by 1.5% by the end of our forecast, and so it leaves the level of GDP broadly unchanged by the time we get to the end of our forecast relative to the outlook back in March.
Is it as simple as this, that the extra public spending gives a short-term boost, but the extra taxes then dampens all that?
Yes, that's right. There are some things in the budget which would deliver a lasting boost to the supply side of the economy and the growth potential of the UK. You know, there's the extra public investment, which should do that, but that takes time to come on stream. And there are also some things in this budget which are actually bad for the supply side of the economy. Putting taxes up on payroll, you know, is bad for the labour supply. And also, you know, that big injection of public spending, that big injection of borrowing, crowds out some private sector activity, some private investment, and that acts as a drag on the long run growth potential of the economy.
Just explain. It's an economist term, crowding out, isn't it? I studied it a very long time ago. But why does spending more as a government, borrowing more as a government, make it harder sometimes for the private sector to do that?
I guess for two reasons. One is that government's just competing with the private sector for resources in the economy. They're competing for people. They're competing for construction materials. And also, by pushing demand above supply, that can also push up borrowing costs. You know, the Bank of England has got to respond to that extra demand in the economy. If that pushes up interest rates, that's also increasing businesses' cost of finance, which means, you know, they've got less resources available to actually invest, and that reduces some business investment in the long term. You do say
the cost of borrowing is going to go up, don't you? Well, we know the Chancellor's changed the rules to allow her to borrow more. Now, she says for very good reason, to borrow to invest in the future, what we call capital stock, building things, schools, hospitals, roads, all the rest of it. But you say there's a price to that. Our mortgages will be higher.
So interest rates will be higher. What that means for mortgages will depend on the decisions made by banks. But we do expect, because there is this fiscal injection into the economy, that's going to boost demand above the supply potential of the economy and require some action to bring that demand back into line with supply by the time you get to the Bank of England.
Forgive me, just translated, that means the Bank of England will keep interest rates, likely to, higher than they otherwise would have done to keep inflation down.
Well, the Bank of England will make its own decisions, but in our forecast, we assume that there's going to be some upward pressure on interest rates as a result of the fact that you're opening up that gap between demand and supply.
Well, let's turn to tax. Big controversy, which you won't want to get into because it's political, about, working people and breaches of promises and so on. What you do get into as an economist and in your forecast is it's a tax on business, but workers are going to pay a lot of it.
So that's right, in the sense that the initial incidence of the rise in national insurance contributions falls on the employer. It costs them about £800 per employee. But we expect that over a number of years, the cost of that tax is passed on to the employee. In the medium term, about three quarters of that cost is ultimately borne by the employee in the form of lower real wages. And so we expect employees to see less real wage growth over the next 5 years than they would otherwise have experienced had this tax not been levied. That leaves about a quarter of the cost of tax, about £200 per employee, falling on employers in the form of lower profit.
Now, another political controversy was whether the last government, the Tories, had left an inverted commas, a black hole. Again, you don't want to get involved in politics, but can I be clear? You do not endorse, it is not your figure to say that the government, the last government, left a £22 billion black hole.
I'm an economist, not an astronomer, so I don't really deal in black holes. But what I do have to do is forecast the public finances. And we looked back and did a review of the preparation of the March 2024 budget. And we found that in the run up to that budget, the Treasury had information about £9.5 billion worth of net pressures on departmental budgets, which they did not share with us in the preparation of that budget. And had we known that information, we would have had a materially different view about the level of public spending this year.
Yeah,
we can't say how different that would have been, because we would have had to have had a different conversation with the Treasury in the light of that information. What we can say is that we do think that spending this year would have been materially higher in that March forecast had we had that.
But that's your number, nine and a bit, not the 22 that's often referred to. There is a point that is often made, which is the Chancellor may need to come back for more. There is so little wriggle room in your forecasts that a little change in interest rates upwards, a little fall in demand for some other reason, could mean that any government, not for political reasons, simply needs to find more cash from us and charge more tax. Is that right?
So the Chancellor has changed the fiscal rules in this budget, but she's kept the practice of her predecessors in setting aside very little headroom, very little margin for manoeuvre against those rules. She's just got £10 billion worth of headroom against her target to balance the current budget, £16 billion against getting net financial liabilities falling. These are about a third of what her predecessors have set aside against their rules. It's a tiny fraction of the changes to our borrowing forecasts over a five-year horizon. Small changes in interest rates, smaller than the ones we even saw in terms of the changes in interest rates between the March budget and this budget, would be enough to eliminate that kind of headroom.
And that means she might have to come back for more.
There are always risks to the outlook, and so Chancellors have to set their fiscal policy in light of those risks. This Chancellor set aside very little margin for manoeuvre against the target she set for us.
Richard Hughes of the Office for Budget Responsibility, thank you very much indeed. We're going to be hearing from the Shadow Chancellor, the previous Chancellor, of course, Jeremy Hunt, at about 7:30, and from the Chancellor at 8:10. And we want to hear from you as well with questions you've got, because we've got our business editor, Simon Jack, coming in, and the FT's personal finance editor. So if you've got a question, not just about how it affects you, you might have a question about what it means for us all. We do want to hear them. 0330 123 4346, or you can email us today@bbc.co.uk.
It's 16 minutes past seven. We've just heard from the Office of Budget Responsibility. Will is back with some business reaction to the OBR's growth outlook. Will.
That's right, Johnny. Yeah, we've got Sir Nigel Wilson with us. Sir Nigel's chairman of the Canary Wharf Group. He was also previously chief executive of Legal & General, one of Britain's biggest investment groups. Sir Nigel, morning.
Good morning.
Just to what Richard Hughes was saying there, I'll ask you the same question Nick put to him. What's your assessment as to why growth isn't performing better in their forecast?
No, because it's basically a very traditional Labour budget, and in a sense, huge increase in public sector spending, driven by taxes on individuals. And there's no private sector analysis whatsoever in either the OVR reports or indeed the budget. And we know that it's really the private sector who's going to have to drive economic growth, drive real wage increases and drive investment. We need to be crowding in private sector investment, not, as the OBR point out, crowding out private sector investment, which is what we've got in the budget so far.
Right. So to be clear, there wasn't enough about how private sector could get involved in some of these projects.
Yes. And I don't think the projects that they're currently thinking through are going to make much of a difference to the economy either. I mean, it's we have £6 trillion of long term capital in the UK, which is an extraordinary amount of money. And we've now got to redeploy that money into growth assets. And so, you know, this is really phase three. Phase one was winning the election, trivial to do. Phase two is actually producing this budget, which has produced no, in fact, it's slightly, we step backwards a bit in terms of economic growth and money in people's pockets. Now we need phase three, which is actually a really detailed plan as to how the private sector is going to drive economic growth by spending, in my view, between £80 billion and £100 billion per year for the next 10 years to deliver real economic growth.
And what are some of those projects? What would you want to see? What do you want to hear?
Well, I think we now need to understand that actually we have all these embryonic growth industries in the UK, but we're too small. We're falling way behind America in terms of our growth and ambition. And we're simply not investing enough in UK growth. And therefore, there wasn't really any plans about housing. There wasn't really any plans about energy. We have the highest energy price in Europe, which is shocking. But we have potentially low-cost energy sitting everywhere across the UK, you know, wind, solar, nuclear fusion even. But and in terms of our growth businesses, this won't be very positive for them right now, because they're sitting this morning thinking, actually, you know, everything's gone up for me. My interest costs are going to go up. My wages are going to go up.
The impact of those tax changes, Nigel, Richard Hughes has forecasted. What do you are in perhaps an even better position to sense what that might mean for business investment?
Well, in the short term, it's not good for business investment. That's why I agree with him that it's crowded out, not crowded in. But actually, now we need to begin to really plan out how we're going to get private sector investment to really want to invest, not only the domestic funds like Legal & General and many others, but also international funds that actually want to come to the UK. People have a very positive disposition towards the UK. It's a great place to invest. London's the best city in the world. But that's not the message that we're giving out to the investment community. We're actually saying, actually, there's going to be all these complicated changes to our tax system and our working arrangements, and this is going to discourage investors initially, but we have to reverse that on a go-forward basis.
So Nigel Wilson, chairman of the Canary Wharf Group, thanks so much for your time.
It is 20 past seven, away from the budget for a moment, because out of nowhere the water seemed to come in eastern Spain, and it kept coming. Floods roaring through the streets and sweeping much of what were in their path out of the way. There's been the worst loss of life since the floods of the 1970s. In Valencia, one main street sees cars tumbled together like matchboxes, all sitting or lying in filthy brown water. 3 days of mourning have been declared, but for many in the affected areas, clearing the debris up will have to come first. Our correspondent, Bethany Bell, is in Valencia.
This is La Torre, which is a residential working class area of Valencia, and there's destruction everywhere. The river is not that close to where I'm standing, but the water must have risen up over the embankment, across a park, and rushed down this street, lifting cars up off the ground. And right in front of me is a car perched precariously on a park bench, pushed there by the force of the water. And everywhere you look underfoot, there's brown, sticky, stinky mud.
And you can see car after car piled up on each other, pushed together with the force of the water. One car's completely upside down, full of debris and branches. Another one smashed right beside it.
That was Bethany Bell. Well, when these events occur, of course, attention turns towards the impact of climate change, how much the warming of our planet contributes to the severity of weather events. Certainly, it feels as if there are more extreme weather events around these days, but feelings are not what the scientists deal in. Dr. Friederike Otto is co-founder and lead of the World Weather Attribution at the Centre for Environmental Policy at Imperial College here in London. They've got a new report looking at the 10 deadliest extreme weather events of the last 20 years. Good morning, Dr. Friederike.
Good morning.
We have seen floods before, obviously. How do you connect those to climate change?
Yes, you're right. Of course, there have been floods before and also other extreme weather events. But what we see particularly in the most recent years, ever stronger, is that many of these extreme weather events are more intense than they would have been without climate change. So with floods like the ones in Spain, we have seen a lot of these types of flood this year, where a lot of rain comes down in a relatively short time, which makes it very hard for people to get out of harm's way. And climate change adds across the world, between 10% and 20% of extra water to these to the rain that causes these floods, and that can make a huge difference in terms of damages.
You know, there is in some quarters considerable scepticism about linking climate change to individual events. How do you sort of come to that number about the impact of these individual events when you say something like, you know, how much worse it is because of climate change? How do you get there?
So we have done this now for 10 years and have developed various different methods so that we combine different lines of evidence. So one method is just looking at the observed record, so just the weather, the measured weather data, and using statistical models to find out what's possible weather today in the world that's 1.3 degrees warmer than it would have been, and compare that with what's possible weather in a world as it would have been, say, at the beginning of the 20th century when it was considerably cooler. Then we use climate models where we can actually do a very clean attribution, because we know very well how many greenhouse gases have been put into the atmosphere since the Industrial Revolution. So we can take these out. And climate models are not something specifically uncertain. They are the same models that we use for the weather forecast. And we know that weather forecasts have become actually really good. And so again, we compare possible weather today with possible weather in the world without climate change. And then, of course, the most important line of evidence is physics. We know from very basic physics that a warmer atmosphere can hold more water vapor, and that needs to get out of the atmosphere, and it does that particularly in heavy bursts of rainfall. And all these lines of evidence show the same thing, that for this heavy kind of rainfall, we see across the world something between 7% and in some cases even more than 20% more rainfall in these heavy bursts.
Dr. Friederike Otto, thank you very much for joining us.
It's coming up to 26 minutes past seven now. We've been asking all week for your suggestions of scary Halloween-themed books, and you've delivered. Iris Hadfield is one of our younger listeners. She didn't just send us a single recommendation. She's got two spooky suggestions.
Hi, I'm Iris, and I'm 7 years old. I love Daisy and the Travel with Vampires, and it's about Daisy. She goes with her next-door neighbour to go trick-or-treating, and then when they're playing in the murder in the graveyard, they fall down a big hole, and then somebody has to get them out, and I think I really like it. And the next one is Isadora Moon, and Isadora Moon is a vampire fairy who's really unique, and she has a cousin called Mirabelle, and he's a witch and half fairy, and they both love to go on adventures with each other, and Mirabelle loves to carry her cauldron pot, and Isadora Moon loves to go around with her fairings, but he doesn't like what Mirabelle eats. And I really like both those series.
And Iris, we really liked having you on the Today programme on the morning of the budget. You've made us all smile in the studio.
Did, didn't we?
We're all grinning.
Lovely.
Isadora Moon, that was one of the recommendations. And Daisy and the Trouble with Vampires was the other one. And you just pay attention to what Iris Hadfield said this morning.
Mike is here with the sports. Something going on in the world of football, Mike?
Yeah, absolutely. Nothing scary at Old Trafford. I've just finished reading the Isadora Moon book to my four-year-old, actually. So Iris is on point. A brilliant suggestion. My four-year-old Erin absolutely loved it as well. As Iris was saying, it's about a little girl who's a half fairy, half vampire. Perfect for the season. But yes, to last night's action at Old Trafford. And crisis, what crisis? They may have sacked their manager on Monday, but on the evidence of last night at least, Manchester United now look to be in rude health.
Fernandes leaves it for Casemiro! Oh, what a strike that is!
We all knew there were 75,000 waiting for us today and millions at home who were supporting us.
Delivers into the area, Garnacho's there for two! Manchester United double their lead!
We're going to go out and give everything for the fans, and that's what they did today.
Over the wall, takes the nick, and Manchester United have a third!
We had to really be getting things going. That worked today to get to the quarterfinals.
Rashford delivers, and headed off the post and away!
That's credit to the players. They were fantastic today. And for me, focus is on Sunday, Chelsea. And further, I don't really look.
Round the goalkeeper, into Danny Ward, and strikes it home in front of the Stretford end. The goals are flowing at Old Trafford.
Interim manager Ruud van Nistelrooy very satisfied to see his side book their place in the quarterfinals of the League Cup last night. They did so with an entertaining 5-2 victory over Leicester City at Old Trafford. Commentator Conor McNamara was there for Five Live and joins us now. Morning, Conor.
Good morning, Mike.
Well, Nick Robinson here was saying earlier he feared a Halloween horror show at Old Trafford. In the end, it was all treat and no tricks, wasn't it, for United? A really impressive victory. But what about that man, van Nistelrooy, in his first match in charge? I know you spoke to him after the game. How did he conduct himself on the touchline?
He looked very comfortable. Down in the tunnel, I could see Leicester City players giving him deferential looks as they passed by. I think he remains a big figure in the game. He looked relaxed in the technical area. He has managerial experience for the past. He won the Dutch Cup in charge of PSV Eindhoven, but I think it's as a player that we all know him and that he's renowned. Arguably the greatest finisher that Manchester United have ever had, and that is saying something. He only ironically scored one goal from outside the penalty area as a Manchester United player. He was very much a poacher in the box, but the first goal of his tenure was struck from outside the area. Casemiro, who had scored the final goal of the Erik ten Hag era at West Ham last week, was to score the first goal of the post-Ten Hag era, struck an unsavourable drive into the top corner. Garnacho got the second goal, which did look offside, but there's no VAR at this stage of the League Cup, so no further scrutiny. And that's the sort of stroke of luck that Erik Ten Hag will feel that maybe he didn't have much of. It was emphasised by Bruno Fernandes, two goals, one of them a free kick, aided by a wild deflection. The other was courtesy of defensive howler. And I'd imagine that Ten Hag will feel that his old team maybe got more slices of good fortune last night than he did in 2 years.
It is widely accepted, though, Conor, isn't it, that van Nistelrooy will not be the permanent manager of Manchester United. What is the latest you're hearing on the arrival of the Sporting Lisbon manager, Ruben Amorim?
Well, it appears to be a done deal. It's all down to timing. The first thing to say about Ruben Amorim is that he is young. He's still in his 30s. He'll become Manchester United's youngest permanent manager since Matt Busby. Busby was only 36 when he was appointed in 1945. Amorim's career has skyrocketed. He sort of started out as a reserve team manager at Braga. He was promoted into the team where the manager got sacked, and he did so well in this caretaker interim, just 2 months, that Sporting, a different club, were to swoop for him. They paid €10 million to Braga to take him. Now remember, this is after just 2 months as a caretaker manager. So this is a guy who's made a big, big impact. Won the league with Sporting, first time they'd done that in nearly 20 years. Won another league last season. And Manchester United is the job he really wants. From what we can make out, he's agreed all the personal terms. The sticking point is that he's under contract with Sporting. They've got a league game tomorrow. They play Manchester City, huge game in the Champions League on Tuesday. So it's not ideal for the Portuguese club to be, you know, seeing their manager up sticks at short notice. And obviously because they paid a hefty fee to sign him in the first place, they want to be compensated themselves. We believe there is further negotiations about the contracts of his backroom staff. We believe Amorim wants to bring them with him too. So look, it seems that barring a dramatic turn of events, Mike Ruben Amorim will become Manchester United's new manager, but they may have to wait until after the November international window before he actually gets to start the job.
All right, great stuff. Got to leave it there, though. Conor McNamara, many thanks for that. Manchester United, should say, will face Tottenham in the quarterfinals of the League Cup after they knocked out Manchester City last night. And finally, brief word on Aberdeen, whose really impressive start to this Scottish Premiership season continued last night. They beat Rangers 2-1 to remain unbeaten in second place in the table, level on points with Celtic, who also won last night. Aberdeen, 9 points ahead of Rangers in third. It is 40 years this season since Aberdeen last won the title in Scotland. Some of their fans daring to dream again.
Thank you very much indeed. I'm still enjoying the memory of those goals. Quick look at the weather now. Today will be cloudy and breezy across western Scotland with drizzle rain for the Northern Islands, cloudy for Northern Ireland and elsewhere. It's going to be drier with sunny spells and variable cloud. We ought to look ahead to what's happening later today on Radio 4, where we're expanding our vocabulary.
Do you ever reach for a word only to discover it doesn't exist?
The word is solembius.
On Unspeakable, we're putting that right with our panel's new verbal inventions.
The feeling when you go on holiday, but it's hotter at home.
We'll find some underused terms that have already been invented.
I offer you a titamatorta.
And some that probably shouldn't have been.
Let's park that word. I haven't used it since I was four, at which point my dear mother taught me to swear properly.
Unspeakable, with me, Phil Wang.
And me, Susie Dent.
The word is wangy.
Yes, I've always thought the definition of wangy was intelligent and suave. Tonight, 6:30 comedy on BBC Sounds and Radio 4.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Johnny Diamond. It is 27 minutes to 8. Let's get a summary of the news from Caroline Nichols.
The International Monetary Fund has welcomed the measures announced by the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, in her budget yesterday. She unveiled tax rises about £40 billion to increase investment and spending on public services. The global watchdog for monetary issues said it supported the sustainable methods for raising revenue to ease the pressure on public services. It also backed the reforms to rules constraining borrowing. But there's been criticism from other groups that businesses will bear too much of the brunt of the tax rises. Richard Hughes, the chair of the Office for Budget Responsibility, told this programme that three quarters of the cost of the tax would be passed on to employees through slower real wage growth. The Spanish government has declared 3 days of national mourning after at least 95 people were killed by flooding. Yesterday, a year's worth of rain fell within 8 hours in the region of Valencia. The floods blocked roads with mud, debris and cars. Emergency teams are searching for missing people. Hundreds of soldiers have been sent to help with the recovery effort. New analysis suggests that human-caused climate change has made the 10 deadliest extreme weather events of the last 20 years more intense and more likely. According to researchers, the storms, heat waves and floods killed at least 570,000 people across Europe, Africa and Asia. The World Weather Attribution Team at Imperial College London developed a method that allows them to discern the fingerprint of climate change in individual weather events. North Korea has fired an intercontinental ballistic missile, which flew for nearly an hour and a half before falling into the sea near Japan. The North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, said it was a warning to enemies who threatened his country's security. The United States called it a breach of UN resolutions. Protection zones around abortion clinics in England and Wales have come into force. It'll be illegal to protest within 150 metres of a centre, but silent prayer won't be automatically banned. The same zones are already in place in Scotland and Northern Ireland.
Thanks, Caroline. Taxes up, spending up, borrowing up. If you are a Conservative, the budget may be a little like shooting fish in a barrel. There are so many easy targets. The challenge, perhaps, for the opposition to explain how they would have paid for the gaps in the public finances identified by the Office for Budget Responsibility, paid for the improvements needed in strained public services, paid for the bills now coming in from public inquiries and the like, let alone find the money for new investment. Just 7 months ago, it was Jeremy Hunt as Chancellor of the Exchequer giving his budget. He joins us now as Shadow Chancellor. Good morning, Mr. Hunt.
Morning, Johnny.
Can we start with the International Monetary Fund's verdict on the budget? Broadly welcoming it, welcomes the focus on boosting growth, supporting the reduction in the deficit, talks about sustainably raising revenue. What do you make of that?
Well, I think the International Monetary Fund has always believed, rightly, that it is very important that public finances are put on a sustainable footing. And I think the central question is how you do that. Now, Rachel Reeves yesterday chose to do that by what I would say, having done her job, is the easy route, which is just to pick the pockets of businesses. They don't have a vote. And most voters probably don't care too much about that. The difficult choice would have been to find more money for the NHS through more challenging paths like welfare reform and productivity savings. If I give you an example, if we reduce the number of adults claiming disability and welfare out-of-work benefits to the levels of 2019, just 5 years ago before the pandemic, that releases £34 billion. Now, that is very challenging and difficult to do. I don't pretend otherwise, but that is what Mel Stride and I were working on doing. And those difficult decisions are also very good for the economy because they get people into work. They're good for the individuals involved because they are, if you've got mental health issues, much better to be in work than out of work. But the Chancellor didn't do that. She didn't do anything significant on public sector productivity, giving train drivers those £10,000 pay rises. The OBR say get productivity back to pre-pandemic levels. That's £20 billion a year. So no one disagrees with the need to find more money for public services like the NHS to avoid austerity cuts. I said many times as Chancellor I wanted to do that, but we'd have done it a different way.
You said you wanted to do that, but your public expenditure plans were nowhere near as generous as what Labour is coming up with, at least in the first couple of years of their government. You weren't going to spend that kind of money on the National Health Service, a National Health Service that is arguably straining at the seams.
Well, in fairness, I put an extra £6 billion into the health service in the budget just in the spring. But I always made it very clear that I didn't want to go back to austerity cuts in public services. But that the trouble with doing it the way that we heard yesterday, the biggest tax raising budget in history, is exactly what the OBR said on the same day. Lower growth, lower living standards, lower wages, businesses employing fewer people. And I think the danger with doing it the way we've done it is that we are actually mortgaging the future of the NHS. Because in the end, the way you pay for the NHS, the police, schools, the armed forces, is actually with a strong economy. And let's be blunt, with a strong private sector. It is businesses paying their taxes that in the end pay for our public services. And what we did not hear yesterday was a plan to grow the economy. And that is what we needed.
You've cited the OBR a couple of times now. Do you accept their verdict on the so-called black hole, the discrepancy in the public finances? They talk about £9.5 billion that they pretty much can't find.
Well, the first thing I would say is that I thought they were going to criticise the previous government. They didn't, and I was wrong on that. But I believe the Chancellor, who told the Sunday Times that there was going to be big criticisms. What they said on that £9.5 billion was that it was impossible to know how much of it would have been compensated for by savings elsewhere. But even if some of it hadn't, we'd have still have been within our fiscal rules. And the big point here, Johnny, is that, you know, even if the Chancellor is right about this £22 billion black hole, and I don't know anyone who actually believes her, but even if she's right, she didn't increase taxes by £22 billion. She increased them by £40 billion. This wasn't about her legacy. This was a conscious choice. Now, if she'd wanted to do that, it's a legitimate choice, not one I agree with. She should have told us before the election.
It's not about her legacy, it's about your legacy.
No, I'm saying
says that the legacy is one of very strained public services but desperately need more money.
What she said is, the reason I'm having to put up taxes is because of this £22 billion fictitious black hole. But she didn't put them up by £22 billion. She put them up by nearly double that. That's why I'm saying it's a choice that she's made. If you're saying, is there a longer-term issue about pressure on our public finances? Absolutely. With an ageing population, with, you know, responding to what Putin's doing in Ukraine, absolutely big pressures on our public services. And that's why you need a long-term plan to tackle those. And that's why our route would have been welfare reform, public sector productivity, taking difficult decisions that would have meant we could have avoided these very damaging tax rises, which I think represent the biggest assault on our economic competitiveness since the 1970s, and is something that the country will really come to regret.
So when the Institute for Fiscal Studies says that your spending plans were implausibly tight, which I think is a polite way of saying that they were just not going to work. What do you say to them?
Well, they made comments like that ahead of the last budget, but in my last budget in the spring, I tried to address that, and let me say very specifically how. And I picked the NHS, which is our biggest public service. Yeah. I said, we have got to really improve productivity in the NHS and give it more resources, but do it on the basis of it operating more efficiently. So I asked the NHS how much they needed for a complete overhaul of their computer systems. They said 3.4 billion. I gave them that money. In return, they said, we're going to improve our efficiency by 2% a year, saving billions and billions of pounds. That is a template which we were going to roll out across the whole of the public sector. And as I say, the OBR say that would have saved about 20 billion pounds a year if we got our productivity up to pre-pandemic levels. So that was our plan. Look, the country rejected that. I fully accept that. Mm. All I would say is that if Rachel Reeves wanted to go a different path to that, she should have said so before the election. And many people this morning are going to wake up feeling very betrayed that they believed her when she said that she didn't have plans to increase taxes outside the Labour manifesto.
We will leave it there. Shadow Chancellor Jeremy Hunt, thank you very much for joining us. We do want to hear from you with your thoughts about the budget, the questions you might have about the impact it'll have. We'll be putting that to an expert panel at 9:15. Do send us your questions. WhatsApp 0330 123 4346, or email today@bbc.co.uk.
Just before Jeremy Hunt leaves the studio, it's quite a moment, your last moment not in a front bench job. You've been in one pretty much ever since 2010.
Yes, it is. There's a little bit of a feeling of the weight of the world lifting from my shoulders, Nick, but not having to talk to you early in the morning is not something I will be missing.
That's one of those moments you regret asking that extra question, isn't it?
Thank you very much. Pleasure. Anyway, have gentlemen, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. Let's turn to the American election now at 16 minutes to 8. 5 days of campaigning remain until the US presidential election, and the opinion polls could barely be closer. Donald Trump has continued to campaign in battleground states after his marathon rally in New York at the weekend. Kamala Harris, meanwhile, spent yesterday in three swing states trying to urge supporters to get the vote out after a day that started with some damage limitation. Our correspondent Tom Bateman was in the press pool travelling with her.
This is Andrews Air Force Base on the tarmac next to Air Force Two, and we're awaiting the Vice President. But as she shows up here, a row about garbage. After the joke that was made by a comedian at the Trump rally in New York over the weekend, where he called Puerto Rico a floating island of garbage, the problem she has now is that President Biden referred to all this last night, saying the only garbage I see floating out there is his supporters. And the Trump campaign have leapt on this, saying he's insulted half the country, as the Vice President is due to show up.
Listen, I think that, first of all, he clarified his comments, but let me be clear, I strongly disagree with any criticism of people based on who they vote for.
And just to follow up on that, do you sympathise if any voters do feel offended?
Once again?
Do you sympathise with any voters who do feel offended by or insulted by the garbage comments?
I am running for president of the United States. I will be traveling to three states today to do what I have been doing throughout, which is talking with the American people. I get it in terms of the concerns they have about challenges like the price of groceries. My highest priority is to address that.
So as she put distance between herself and Biden, we got closer to the battlegrounds. The election is being fought in the dwindling middle, people who could still be persuaded for either Trump or Harris. So, a rally in Raleigh, North Carolina.
So we're being led close to the stage. I can see the bulletproof glass in front of the podium. And a cheer coming up. I think as the crowd can tell that the motorcade has already arrived.
Hello, North Carolina.
It begins with a surprise warm-up act in front of these Democrat loyalists.
My name is Jennifer Bell. One thing we may not have a lot in common with is the fact that up until 2020, I consider myself an outspoken Republican voter. Yes, get it out. I deserve it. I deserve it.
This is the voter Harris wants to win over in the suburbs of North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. Women who would vote Republican but flinch at Donald Trump, particularly over his track record on abortion and reproductive rights.
Can we get another chance? When I say comma, you say love. Comma. Comma.
But she still hasn't been able to budge the polling numbers enough after her party ousted Joe Biden. So this still feels more like a race of opposing negatives, where voters are asked to stop what they don't want. Next, in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, where the election could be decided.
We are here together because we know what's on the line. We know that Donald Trump will try, like he has so many times, to get rid of the Affordable Care Act, which would throw millions of Americans off of their health care. You remember what that was? Well, we are not going back. And here is my pledge to you. As your president, I pledge to seek common ground and common sense solutions to the challenges you face.
In seats close to the stage, a man holds up a Palestinian flag and shouts, "You're a war criminal." It is the fourth time so far this has happened in a few hours. By the end of the day, there will be a fifth. It is a sign of how potent, how divisive this issue has become for the Democrats.
And let me say, look, I'll repeat it. We are fighting for a democracy. We love our democracy. It can be complicated at times, but it is the best system in the world.
Harris ends with a common refrain.
And are we ready to fight for it? And when we fight, we win. God bless you.
This does feel like the energy election. It's everywhere you turn. Harris rallies, Trump turning out his highly motivated fans. She has well outspent him, thanks to a late grassroots fundraising surge. But their bases are not the problem. It is turning out the people that don't show up to these mostly stage-managed events. They will be decisive in which way America turns on Tuesday.
Tom Bateman reporting there, less than a week to go. Now it's time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is Reverend Lucy Winkett, Rector of St James, Piccadilly.
Good morning. We're all longing to be haunted. The Norfolk composer Laura Cannell made that observation on this programme on Tuesday. An appropriate comment, perhaps, for today, All Hallows' Eve, also known as Halloween. She was talking, though, about the music of the 12th century composer Hildegard of Bingen. Hildegard's music comes to us from 800 years ago. She was one of the most startlingly original composers of her time, making music for women religious to sing in praise of God, in dedication to the earth, and expressing a gritty appreciation of what it's like to be human, subject as we are to the temptations and cruelties of life in the world. Her melodies are ethereal, evocative, intimations of another world beyond what's here now. We're all longing to be haunted. I think that what the composer meant was that when we lift our eyes from the day to day, we're hoping for more. We're hoping that we have been made for more than this, that we can by our intuition sense more than this. Especially when life is tough and when money worries, family worries, practicalities and challenges seem to dominate getting through the day. This day, Halloween, is closely related in the Christian tradition to tomorrow, All Saints, and the day after that, All Souls. Multiple days set aside one after the other at this time of year. They're there in Christian spiritual practice to help express the deep fears and persistent hopes human beings have when we face the truth that all of us, without exception, are going to die. These 3 days, All Hallows' Eve, All Saints and All Souls, can be a moment to address death squarely in the face, contemplate the end of our life, which in turn encourages us to live and live well. And although the commercialisation of Halloween risks trivialising what could be a really powerful and useful collective moment, the laughing and the dressing up, the introduction of death into an ordinary working day or a party gathering at night still socialises an important truth that the rest of the time we try to avoid. That life is short. And that I and everyone I love will be dead for a very long time. The gallows humour, the playful embrace of the macabre. It's all part of our attempt to live with the fact that we'll die, and our wonderings about what happens to us when we do. In the midst of life, we are in death, says the Book of Common Prayer. For Christians, a hopeful and truthful statement that breaks through our denial and helps us take the gift of life as seriously as it deserves.
That was Thought for the Day with the Reverend Lucy Winkett.
Time now is 7 minutes to 8. The Chancellor insists she had no choice but to increase our taxes to deal with the unpaid bills the Conservatives left for her and to deal with the crises affecting our public services. Her choice, she says, as we'll no doubt hear from her directly at 8:10, was to ask businesses to foot the bill, not workers directly. But a big tax rise, increasing the amount that those businesses pay in national insurance, will, according to the government's official forecasters, be paid by their employees. Earlier, Will Bain, our business presenter, spoke to Wayne Chapman, who runs a chief executive officer at Starzy UK, a logistics company. Will asked him what the combination of changes to national insurance and the minimum wage would cost his business.
From us, it's about a £2 million increase on our payroll. It's a 30% increase. So, as an example, if you take someone on a 30,000 salary, we'd have been paying around £2,800 per year in national insurance on top of that. That's going to increase to £3,750. We were not forecasting that to come through. We thought there might be some element of reduction in the base rate of national insurance, but not the reduction in the threshold of down to £5,000. That was a real shock to the system.
Listening to that, Nick Glynn, Chief Executive, founder of the Buy It Direct Group, which includes brands you'll be familiar with, Appliances Direct, Better Bathrooms, Furniture 123. Morning to you, Mr. Glynn. Is that the sort of picture in your businesses?
Absolutely. I mean, it came as a total shock, the rise in the threshold. And the impact on our business is massive. Last night we had an emergency board meeting, and we estimate is £1.5 million additional cost next year. That's on a business that makes around £8 million profit. So a massive dent in our budget.
Which will mean what?
Well, it means a number of things. One, if staff come looking for a significant wage increase next year, we're going to have to calculate we've already had a 6% increase. And by 6%, it's not just the national insurance increase, it's also the increase in the national minimum wage. Second thing, we're not going to be doing anything speculative, which would involve employment. And thirdly, we're going to continue accelerate our plans to outsource. At the moment, we've got 150 people working abroad for us, and I can't see why we shouldn't have an overseas first employment strategy given this increase in tax on jobs.
Just spell out what you mean, if you would, by not doing anything speculative. Do you mean not taking risks, not making a sort of investment that might pay off but might not? You can't afford to take
absolutely
that risk.
I mean, the type of investments we will be making, which is, I suppose, the positive side of this budget, is investments in efficiency and automation. Anything can reduce our dependency on labour. However, there's loads of other plans that we had around increasing our brand, increasing our marketing, which would have involved taking on staff. Now we're going to be thinking twice, three times before we do that.
Increases in efficiency translates, if you're a worker, to fewer jobs.
Absolutely. It's fewer jobs and also less wage increases.
So what do you think when you hear the Chancellor say this is a budget for growth?
I think it's nonsense. This is a tax raid. It's classic Labour of tax, borrow and spend. There's not a growth element in the budget. And, you know, that's what we're expecting. It's just so negative.
She would say, I think, in reply, wouldn't she? Look, long-term investment makes sense in skills, in the infrastructure of the country. Business depends on that. And also, your workers depend on having public services that work, not a health service that keeps them off work because they're endlessly waiting in lists.
Sure. I mean, there could be something. The gamble is that the demand side is it increases, and therefore we can sell more goods, and people out there feel more confident and can spend more. But it's a massive gamble, and the only people and the only risk here is not on the country but on businesses.
There's a joke. There's a joke in the front page of the Telegraph cartoon, Matt, saying, you know, I thought uncertainty was the worst thing for business. Maybe this budget is even worse. Are you saying you're more gloomy today than you were when you didn't know what was in the budget?
Absolutely, it's worse than we thought it would be.
Nick Glynn, Chief Executive and Founder of the Buy It Direct Group. Thank you very much indeed for joining us.
What have we got?
On BBC iPlayer, all I know is somebody's behind all this.
You can just walk away.
You should investigate. I got the
blues. These aren't crime dramas.
What the hell are you playing at?
They're a break from your work dramas.
How does all this make you feel?
Well done, everybody.
Dead and Buried, Line of Duty, Luther, and loads more.
We're throwing you a lifeline here, mate.
Whoever you are, whyever you stream, BBC iPlayer.
Coming up to 2 minutes to eight, Elizabeth Rizzini is here with the weather.
Thanks, Nick. Well, quite the range of temperatures this morning. 14 Celsius to start the day in Aberdeenshire, just 5 or 6 in Oxfordshire here. There is quite a lot of mist and fog around this morning still, but high pressure is dominant, not just today, but also as we head through much of the rest of the week and into next week as well. So generally it's dry and it's settled. A few exceptions to that. There is a bit of drizzle out towards northern and western coasts at the moment. And there will be some rain a bit later on in the day across northwest Scotland as well. But lots of dry weather around. It is rather grey, and all of this set to last as we head through the next few days as well. Temperatures generally mild for the time of year. So it is a foggy start for some, particularly dense fog. So poor visibility across parts of Oxfordshire, Wiltshire and Somerset at the moment. Central, southern and eastern areas of the UK will stay dry. The winds are light here and that early mist and fog will lift. And the cloud will start to break up a little. There'll be some sunny spells, particularly towards the lee of high ground and across eastern coastal areas of England too. For northeast Scotland, there'll also be some sunny spells developing, and we could see quite high temperatures here, perhaps across parts of Aberdeenshire with a bit of fern effect in place. So for Northern Ireland, Northern England, then there's a bit of drizzle around. It's murky, there's plenty of low cloud, but it should stay mostly dry today, and it's a bit breezier here than it was yesterday. But for northwest Scotland, it's windier, gusts of wind of around 40 to 50 miles an hour, especially across the Northern Isles, and there'll be some rain pushing in later on in the morning, lasting into the afternoon. And then that cold front will gradually drift its way further southwards and eastwards through tonight and tomorrow. Overnight tonight, then it does stay mild. There'll be some more mist and fog developing, plenty of low cloud around. Temperatures generally down to around 7 to 10 degrees.
Thanks very much, Elizabeth. You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Johnny Diamond.
Good morning. It's 8 o'clock on Thursday, the 31st of October. The headlines this morning: the International Monetary Fund has backed the big increases in tax and spending in yesterday's budget, but critics say growth and living standards will remain weak. The Chancellor will be joining us after the news. Spain has deployed troops to help rescue efforts after flash floods killed at least 95 people.
And coming up in the next hour, we will hear from Ukraine, where our correspondent Yogita Limaye reports on the rise in drone attacks in Kherson. And when words fail us, Radio 4 comedy is here.
You know the person, the neighbour, who always puts their bin out first on bin day? You know exactly which one it is. Everyone else follows suit. They are a binfluencer.
Lexicographer Susie Dent joins comedian Phil Wang to tell us about their new radio show, Unspeakable, making up the words we really need. The BBC News is read by Caroline Nichols.
In a rare move, the International Monetary Fund has welcomed the measures announced by the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, in her budget yesterday. She unveiled tax increases worth about £40 billion in order to increase investment and spending on public services. Employers have voiced concern that they're bearing the brunt of the biggest tax rises in a generation, as our economics editor Faisal Islam reports.
The IMF welcomed yesterday's budget after one of the most consequential financial statements in recent history. The fund, which last week told BBC News that a boost to investment was much needed, backed sustainably raising revenue, i.e. tax rises, to help reduce the deficit, the addressing of urgent pressures in public spending, and some changes to the rules constraining borrowing. It was helpful support to the Chancellor after she decided on blockbuster increases in spending, taxation, borrowing and investment. A £76 billion a year rise in spending will take taxation to the highest level on record and spending closer to continental European levels. The UK is set for the highest sustained level of public investment in major capital projects for 50 years, which could, for example, help reinstate entirely a green energy promise dropped ahead of the election. Some businesses have expressed concern about shouldering the increase in the tax burden, with particular backlash on the application of inheritance tax to agricultural land. Interest rates facing government borrowing were up a touch yesterday, but markets were calm in general, with no repeat of the infamous mini-budget 2 years ago.
The independent forecaster, the Office for Budget Responsibility, says that as a result of the budget, economic growth will accelerate in the next 2 years, but slow down again after that. The chairman of the property company, the Canary Wharf Group, Sir Nigel Wilson, told us why he thought the prospects for growth were disappointing.
Because it's basically a very traditional Labour budget, and in a sense, huge increase in public sector spending driven by taxes. And there's no private sector analysis whatsoever. And we know that it's really the private sector who's going to have to drive economic growth. Now we need to begin to plan out how we're going to get private sector investment to really want to invest.
Speaking on this programme, the Shadow Chancellor and former Chancellor, Jeremy Hunt, said the government was taking the easy route by picking the pockets of businesses because they don't have the vote.
The trouble with doing it the way that we heard yesterday, the biggest tax-raising budget in history, is exactly what the OBR said on the same day. Lower growth, lower living standards, lower wages, businesses employing fewer people. And what we did not hear yesterday was a plan to grow the economy.
The first Labour budget in nearly 15 years marked a decisive shift from the planned cuts set out by the last government. But according to the living standards think tank, the Resolution Foundation, the outlook for economic growth and living standards will remain weak in this parliament. Andy Verity has the details.
The Resolution Foundation says the budget will front-load much of its spending boost, with day-to-day spending rising by £35 billion and health taking up 42% of all departmental spending in the coming financial year, compared to 31% in 2007. That leaves less to spend further down the road, implying real cuts in spending per person on unprotected departments outside health and education, sending their funding back to 2015-16 levels. The think tank says the short-term effect of borrowing an additional £32 billion a year and raising taxes to the tune of £41 billion a year will still mean better funded public services from hospitals to schools to the courts. But because of benefit cuts and the knock-on effect of higher taxes, household disposable income per person is projected to grow in real terms by 0.5% a year on average across the parliament. That would be faster than the last parliament, but still the worst 5 years for living standards recorded under a Labour government.
Emergency teams in Spain are searching for those missing in the worst floods to hit the country in decades. At least 95 people have been killed, nearly all of them in the Valencia region, where a year's worth of rain fell in just 8 hours yesterday. Many roads are blocked by mud, debris and cars which had been swept away. Our Europe correspondent, Bethany Bell, sent this report from Valencia.
Spain is reeling from what's been described as one of the worst natural disasters in its recent history. Rescue workers are struggling to find the missing. Officials say it's not yet clear how many people are still unaccounted for. Some places can only be reached by helicopter. Hundreds of soldiers have been deployed to help with the rescue effort. Some local officials have complained that the flood warnings came too late. The Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, said those affected would not be abandoned. He extended his condolences to those who'd lost their loved ones. "The whole of Spain weeps with you," he said. 3 days of mourning have been declared.
The largest storm to hit Taiwan in nearly 30 years has made landfall, bringing winds of over 130 miles per hour and waves of up to 10 metres high. Officials said one person has been killed and more than 70 injured in super typhoon Kong Rei. Thousands of people have been evacuated and all schools and offices are shut on the island. New analysis suggests that human-caused climate change has made the 10 deadliest extreme weather events of the last 20 years more intense and more likely. The killer storms, heat waves and floods left at least 570,000 people dead across Europe, Africa and Asia. The study has been released to mark the 10th anniversary of the World Weather Attribution Team at Imperial College London. The lead author, Freddie Otto, told this programme that climate change was making flooding worse.
We have seen a lot of these types of flood this year where a lot of rain comes down in a relatively short time, which makes it very hard for people to get out of harm's way. And climate change adds across the world between 10 and 20% of extra water to the rain that causes these floods. And that can make a huge difference in terms of damages.
North Korea has fired an intercontinental ballistic missile, which flew for nearly an hour and a half before falling into the sea near Japan. The North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, said it was a warning to enemies. Its ally China has expressed concern. Our correspondent, Shaima Khalil, reports from Tokyo.
Pyongyang said the intercontinental ballistic missile launch set a record exceeding their previous tests. The defense ministry in Tokyo said the ICBM was in the air for 1 hour and 26 minutes, longer than any other missile tested by the North. Defense officials in Seoul have said the test was intended to develop weapons that fire farther and higher, adding that it was possibly aimed at increasing the payload of the missile. South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff say the missile was launched from near Pyongyang and flew around more than 600 miles east before landing near Japan outside the country's territorial waters. Officials in Seoul said the missile might have used a newly developed solid fuel booster. They added that it was fired at a sharply high angle, which implies the missile could fly far into the Pacific towards the United States if fired at a lower angle.
The world's richest man, Elon Musk, has been told to appear in court later today after his political campaign group started giving away $1 million a day to a different voter in key states in the US presidential election. The Philadelphia district attorney has described the move as an illegal lottery. Mr. Musk is a high-profile backer of Donald Trump. Here's our North America correspondent, Rowan Bridge.
Elon Musk caused quite a splash earlier this month when he started giving away $1 million a day in one of seven key states. In order to qualify, people had to be registered to vote and sign his petition supporting free speech and gun rights. There were questions as to whether the move broke election law, which makes it illegal to pay someone to vote or register to vote. Now the Philadelphia District Attorney has accused Mr. Musk's campaign group, America PAC, of holding an illegal lottery that enticed residents to share personal data. Mr. Musk, who's appeared at a number of Trump rallies recently, is due to make a different type of appearance later today after the judge ordered all parties in the case to attend the hearing.
Protection zones around abortion clinics in England and Wales have come into force, making it illegal to protest within 150 metres of them. Anyone breaking the law will face an unlimited fine. But silent prayer won't be banned within the zones. The government says police will deal with it on a case-by-case basis. The same zones are already in force in Scotland and Northern Ireland. A trial suggests that a therapy combining three drugs targeting advanced breast cancer could potentially double the amount of time patients live without the disease progressing. The study, published in the New England Journal of Medicine, involved 325 patients. The combined therapy, including a new drug called inavolisib, delayed disease progression by an average of 15 months.
Caroline, thank you very much indeed. It's 10 past eight. On the morning after the budget before, it often pays to study the small print, to look for the hidden nasties, a tax rise here, a spending cut there. On this morning, the stark budget facts are staring us all in the face, and they're not pretty. Rachel Reeves, who declared last year she had no plans to be a big tax-raising chancellor, announced huge tax rises of the sort normally only ever seen in response to a crisis, a recession or a pandemic. The biggest, the rise in national insurance, is the equivalent of every household in Britain paying an extra £18 every single week. Borrowing is going up on a scale unseen for many years. And yet, after all this, the official forecasts say that growth, which the Chancellor says is her real target, will increase a little, but then fall back to levels way below the rates of growth we enjoyed for decades, the rates we've always relied on in this country to pay for improved living standards and better public services. Well, on that morning after the budget before, I'm delighted to say we're joined by the Chancellor herself, the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Nick.
This was in many ways the first budget of a new era. You had some very, very big decisions to take. So how disappointed were you when the official forecasters came to you and said, your policies are not increasing the growth rate of Britain? They are net, making no difference at all over the next few years.
A Chancellor doesn't decide the circumstances in which they give a budget, especially their first budget, because it's the inheritance from the previous government. But I had some important choices to make yesterday. The first was whether I wanted to sweep things under the carpet, as the previous government have done, or whether I wanted to be open and transparent about the challenges we face and then fix them. And I chose to be a responsible Chancellor. Not all Chancellors in the last few years have been responsible, but I will be. And then the second choice that I had, recognising those huge pressures on the public finances and indeed pressures on public services, was how to raise the money. And I chose to increase national insurance on employers. There were other choices available. I could have increased income tax or national insurance on employees. But I felt that after the cost of living crisis over the last few years, that would have been the wrong choice. Mm. Now, you ask about economic growth. The OBR say that it is largely unchanged overall during the course of this parliament. But they also, for the first time, look at the growth impact beyond the parliament. And that's really important. Because often politicians, I'm sure you would agree, make short-term decisions rather than decisions in the long-term interests of the country. And by forecasting and looking beyond the five-year period, it holds ministers to account for making those long-term decisions. And they say particularly our investments in infrastructure can boost growth by 1.4% over the longer term. So we're putting our country on a better path on growth, public services and the investment going into those, especially the NHS, but also a better path in terms of our public finances that we are determined to fix.
Well, that is your case. That's the backdrop. Let's explore some of those things individually. A little bit of speed, if you don't mind, just to make sure that we get through all of those. Growth is your target. You are saying perfectly fairly that there is some sign that by borrowing more to invest, you will get some benefits in many years to come. But you said only this year, in May, to a business summit, I know economic growth comes from the success of business. There is no other way, said Rachel Reeves. So why are you putting a £25 billion tax on British business, something you yourself called in the past a jobs tax?
I'll say two things. First of all, just a couple of weeks ago, we hosted an international investment summit in London, the first one under this government. And investors announced £63.5 billion worth of investment into the United Kingdom. That is a vote of confidence in this government and what we are doing. But the second thing that I would say is that I've always been really clear that the most important thing for growing our economy is bringing stability back to our economy. And if yesterday I had swept the problems under the carpet, pretended they weren't there, do half measures and then come back next year and try and increase taxes again, businesses would rightly have said, she hasn't got a plan, she hasn't got a grip. That's not the sort of Chancellor I'm going to be.
But we've had businesses on the programme, you see. And I put that very point to the founder of the Buy It Direct Group, big consumer group, a man called Nick Glynn. And he hears what you say, but he also said to us, the cost of a company with only £8 million profits of your announcements is £1.5 million. So specifically on this, if you wouldn't mind, Chancellor, do you stick to your words that you said in the past that a national insurance rise on business is, quotes, a jobs tax which takes money out of people's pockets?
Say yesterday that this will have an impact on wage growth, for example. But
so it is a jobs tax which will take money out of people's pockets, just to be clear.
Well, look, what alternative was there? We had a £22 billion black hole in the public finances.
Well, the alternative is to spend less, is to borrow less, is not to tax businesses in something you call a jobs tax.
Well, we face a £22 billion black hole in the public finances.
Your figure, not the official figures.
Well, we published yesterday, Nick, a line-by-line breakdown of those £22 billion of unfunded commitments. So they're now there for everybody to see and to pore over. But that £22 billion is a real number.
But it's not the number produced by the Office for Budget Responsibility or on the programme earlier. Well, they made very clear it's not their number. They talked about £9.8 billion. It's a big amount of money, and you may be very critical. And they made clear in their report yesterday that it is your choices. Your choices about how much to spend, tax and borrow, that dwarf any sort of problem that was left for you by the Conservatives.
Well, Nick, their number looks at a meeting that they had with the Treasury in February ahead of the spring budget. And they say that the reserve was already fully spent with £9.5 billion more in addition spent over that. By the time it got to the general election on the 4th of July, that figure was £21.9 billion. And we've published all of the details of that yesterday. So we had to close that gap. We had to properly fund compensation packages for the victims of infected blood and the Post Office Horizon scandal. So we had to increase taxes yesterday. I did not want to increase the key taxes that working people pay, income tax, VAT and employee national insurance. So we have increased national insurance on employers. We've protected the smallest businesses. Anyone employing four people on the national living wage won't pay a penny of national insurance. And indeed, a million small businesses will be paying either less or the same national insurance as what they're currently
leaving
paying.
Leaving 29 so million companies to pay more way. And according to the official forecast, £6 out of every £10 of a business taxes will be paid by workers in lower wages. In a sense, you're not disputing that, Charles. You've said it was a difficult choice, but a choice that you had to take. So let me turn to another choice, which is a choice about borrowing. You changed the rules to allow you to borrow billions of pounds more. Now, the official forecasts say we will all pay for that as well, because mortgages will go up. That is what the Office for Budget Responsibility forecast.
Well, the Office of Budget Responsibility say that interest rates will fall over the course of this parliament. And that is a far cry from the last parliament, when inflation went to above 11% and mortgage rates went through the roof because the previous government chose a path of irresponsibility.
Forgive me interrupting, just to point out, they do say they'll go up by 0.25% because of the decisions you took.
Well, that's not quite what they say. They say that they will be 25 basis points higher than they might otherwise have been. But they are comparing to a forecast in March that they now say would have been materially different if they had known about the overspending of the previous government. But overall, they are forecasting that interest rates will come down during the course of this parliament. Now, that's up to the Independent Bank of England to make those decisions. I was an economist there before I became a politician. I respect their independence, and they will make those decisions based on their target of 2% CPI inflation.
And also partly based on what the money markets are doing. And at the moment, the money markets are pricing British debt higher. In other words, to translate the jargon that you understand better than almost anybody else, the cost of long-term borrowing in this country has gone up because the markets are a bit nervy.
Well, I'm not going to comment on market movements, but what I will say is the International Monetary Fund said yesterday that this budget was making the right decisions to put our country back on a path of fiscal sustainability, but also making the long-term decisions to grow the economy. That should give investors in the UK, whether they are investors in infrastructure in the UK or indeed they are investors in government bonds, that should give investors confidence that the decisions we took yesterday were the right decisions to get our country back on the right path, as well as sorting out the public finances. We also yesterday put significant investment into our National Health Service. Healthy businesses need a healthy NHS. And yesterday, with that commitment to meet our target of 40,000 additional appointments every single week in the NHS, we can confirm that we can now achieve that target and get those waiting lists down.
The Health Secretary said a few weeks ago, pouring an ever-increasing amount of money into a system that isn't working is wasteful in every sense. Isn't that precisely what you're doing? Spending billions of pounds in the short term, not just for a health service that hasn't been reformed. You haven't even published the proposals for reform.
Well, we said in the election that the health service and our schools needed an immediate injection of cash. We provided that immediate injection yesterday. But along with that, there is a 2% efficiency and productivity target this year and next in the NHS. And indeed, we've gone further than the previous government did in terms of driving productivity and efficiency by extending that target to all government departments.
Understood.
To make sure that we're getting value for money.
I know you've other places to go, other interviews to do, and I deliberately have tried to focus on policy, on economics, not on politics, if you like. But I'm going to end with that. Do you wince when I quote back words you said in the election? Every Labour policy will be fully funded and fully costed. No ifs, no ands, no buts.
When I became Chancellor on the 5th of July, I had no idea about all the unfunded commitments that the previous government had made.
You should have listened to the Today programme because we asked you about it. We asked the Prime Minister about it, as he is now. Repeatedly I asked Labour spokesman that the figures didn't add up. And you said, I haven't got plans to be a big tax-raising Chancellor. And you had.
Nick, I think this is really important because nobody knew about this in-year overspend. It's why when we get the monthly borrowing numbers, in the 6 months of this year, they are already running £11 billion higher. Times that by two to take us to the full year, that's £22 billion, more than the OBR forecast in March because the previous government withheld that information.
I didn't get
to choose the circumstances, but I do own the decisions I made yesterday. They are the right ones to get our public finances back on a sustainable path, to put the money into the National Health Service and to do everything within our power to protect the incomes and the living standards of working people.
Listeners will make their choice. At best, isn't it arguable you weren't open with people? At worst, that you were downright dishonest about what was inevitably going to happen after you came to office?
Well, we made commitments not to increase the key taxes that working people pay, income tax, employee national insurance and VAT. And we committed to not raise the corporation tax rate from its current rate of 25%. Those are commitments we've made for the duration of this parliament, and we'll stick by those commitments. I had to make difficult choices yesterday. I'm not denying that, but that is what was necessary to put our public finances on a stable trajectory, to get the money we need for our public services and to start to rebuild our country with significant investments in energy infrastructure, in transport projects, in digital rollout, all of those things which the IMF and the OBR say will start to boost the growth potential of our country and give our country some hope back and our future back. There are massive opportunities if we seize them. I want to be the government, I want to be the Chancellor that takes the advantage of those big opportunities and gets that investment and gets those jobs to Britain. The budget yesterday was a start of doing just that.
Rachel Reeves, Chancellor of the Exchequer. After a long day and another long day ahead, we're grateful for so much time. Thank you for joining us.
It is 24 minutes past eight. The budget is an economic event, but it's also certainly a political event. And Chris Mason, our political editor, has been listening through to that. Chris, can I start with the national insurance rise? Mm-hmm. It was heavily trailed. Did that heavy trailing, do you think, take the sting out of what looks to many like an open breach of the manifesto commitment on taxes?
I think it took some of the surprise away. It maybe prolonged the sting. We've seen Rachel Reeves and others, haven't we, in the last couple of weeks, try to dance around where commas and emphases lay in a manifesto of a couple of months ago, which it wasn't unreasonable to interpret at brief glance might have suggested that national insurance in its entirety was ring-fenced from the grabby hand of a new Chancellor, which didn't quite turn out to be the case. And that bigger picture point that Nick was just alighting on with Rachel Reeves towards the end of the conversation there, it seems to me it is not widely uncharitable to point out that the gap between the tone and the language and the emphases of senior Labour folk during the campaign, which was lots of reassuring language around tax, and where we are now, is a Grand Canyon-like in its gap. The breadth is huge because the scale of the budget was huge. This was a huge change-making budget where everywhere you look was big numbers. And that's very different from where we were a few months ago. Now, Rachel Reeves will say, look, actually, you know, the mitigating plea is what the last government did. But even if you price in an element of that, that gap is still massive.
Do you get any sense from the Labour benches of a word I know you like, blimey, that's a lot? Or are they generally cock-a-hoop?
I think it's a bit of both, actually. So, I mean, so many of them are just so pleased that after a decade and a half, there's actually a budget with Labour's name on it, and plenty are proud that it is, you know, doesn't just have a red cover, because they always have a red cover on the front of a budget. It feels red, politically red, to them. It's doing what plenty of Labour folk have been craving a government to do for so long. In fact, some quite surprised that it's done as much as they might have that it might have dreamed of. But, and this is the big but in all of this, what happens to the big picture? And actually, the big picture in economics in the end is the small picture, isn't it? How do people feel in the coming years economically? And there's two elements to this. There's those figures around growth. Now, realistically, the budget was not necessarily likely in the click of a finger to transform the country's growth prospects overnight, but those growth forecasts are anemic. And when you look at the prospects for disposable household income per person, in other words, how well off we feel, it's marginally better than in the last parliament, but the last parliament was dire. So it's entirely possible, according to the current forecast, that you get a couple of years ahead towards the end of this parliament, and lots of people are feeling still pretty cheesed off about a further extension in really bleak economic backdrop. And where does that leave a government? Probably not in a good place. More importantly, where does it leave the country? Where does it leave people feeling? And as things stand, things don't look great.
No, and that must set alarm bells ringing for any government hoping for re-election, as this budget is supposed to be sort of setting up for the next few years.
Yeah, and I think that's the, if you put on the two sides of the political and economic ledger here. On the political ledger, you have this government with a colossal, massive majority, you know, no superlative is quite adequate to describe the size of their majority. And yet you have this economic backdrop stretching back, you know, the best part of 20 years now to the financial crisis, which is bleak. And I think if you put those two things together, what you see is that when you have that sustained period of a lack of any sense of economic growth, that seems to me to be a contributory factor to an anti-politics mood, to the wild swings that we've seen in the political fortunes of the big parties. It keeps things sharp for the political parties because, my goodness, even with that colossal majority, nothing is guaranteed.
Chris, as always, thank you very much indeed. Chris Mason, our political editor there.
29 minutes past eight. Mike is back with the sport. No doubt, Mike, you want to replay all of Manchester United's goals, all five of them.
We can't indulge you all morning, Nick. We did that last hour, yes. Five goals for Manchester United last night as they dispatched Leicester City at Old Trafford to book their place in the quarterfinals of the League Cup, where they will face Tottenham in December. Tottenham beating Manchester City last night. You can see the full draw for the last eight of the League Cup on the BBC Sport website. Meanwhile, drama overnight in the United States.
Start the party, Los Angeles! Your Dodgers have won the World Series!
Yes, huge baseball news this morning. The Los Angeles Dodgers clinched the 2024 World Series after recovering from 5-0 down to beat the New York Yankees 7-6 at Yankee Stadium and seal a 4-1 series victory. We, though, are going to talk cricket now because England begin their three-match one-day series of the West Indies later today after what has been a pretty miserable 12 months for England's white ball side. They made meek defences of both their one-day and T20 World Cup titles and lost a home series to Australia as well. They're now back in the Caribbean in the last series before the new incoming white ball coach Brendan McCullum takes over in the new year. So let's head inside the England camp and hear from all-rounder Sam Curran. Does he feel that teammates will be out in this series to impress the new regime?
Yeah, I'm sure. I think obviously with the new coach coming in, it'll be really exciting for a lot of guys. He's obviously done some great things with the test team, so the guys are really excited. And this tour with 3 one-day games and 5 T20 internationals is a fantastic opportunity for a lot of guys. And yeah, they're vibe in the training sessions has been really exciting, a lot of energy and a lot of new faces. So yeah, I'm sure there's lots of guys with their own ambitions, but most importantly, we'll be trying to get that series win and get the team back to winning ways.
What's your own relationship with McCullum like? There were a few raised eyebrows earlier this summer when you were overlooked as a replacement for Ben Stokes in the Test side when the captain was ruled out of the Sri Lanka series with injury. A lot of people thought you would have been the natural all-round replacement. Does that leave you with a point to prove to the coach as well?
Not really, to be fair. I think I actually feel quite reasonably experienced within the group that's here at the moment. So, yeah, really looking forward to hopefully getting some nice performances in for the team. I know Brendan reasonably well, having worked with him as a coach. So we've crossed paths on the pitch a few times all around the world and things like that. It's a really exciting time. We've had quite a nice little break after the season. So, yeah, raring to go and fingers crossed can be a good series.
And Sam, I'm not sure about the players, but I know a lot of cricket fans are still getting their heads around this new global scheduling of matches for a national side across different formats of the game. A busy schedule that sees the England Test side lose a series in Pakistan less than a week ago, only for the England white ball team to pop up on the other side of the world 5 days later to start a limited overs series in the Caribbean, all squeezed in before the Test side go back round the other side of the world for a Test series in New Zealand at the end of November. It's all a bit of a whirlwind, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's there's no doubt that the schedule is extremely busy. And like you said, there's a lot of crossover between formats. As players, you just got to get on with, with what's in front of you. On the field, guys love playing cricket, but at the same time, you got to make sure the scheduling and the games that are planned are pretty sensible. And like you said, it's extremely busy period now. And there's obviously guys going to New Zealand pretty soon with a Test team. I guess that's why there's probably a bit of a younger squad here. Guys can't really do everything at the moment. But yeah, I think it's a huge opportunity for other players to get that chance to be around the England environment. It's an extremely busy period for England in general because they are a very popular cricketing nation and a lot of teams want to play against England. So I guess it's just, you got to, as players, you just crack on and do your best.
Oh, and before you go, Sam, need to ask you the really big question. We, of course, await official team news later for this first ODI, but one of England's four debutants, Michael Pepper, could be in line to open the batting alongside Phil Salt, leaving us with the mouth-watering prospect of having a Salt and Pepper opening batting partnership for England in a year.
Well, I'm sure a lot of people with all the social media channels, I'm sure, will be buzzing if that does happen. But I guess that comes down to the coach and selectors and captains. So, yeah, would be quite funny, wouldn't it?
It's a headline writer's dream, isn't it? Salt and Pepper opening.
How long did you take to come up with that one, Mike?
It might not happen, but if it does, you heard it here first. It would be some perfect seasoning to England's batting out in the Caribbean. I'll get my coat.
Mike, thanks very much indeed. In our time is at 9. Here's Melvin Bragg with the details.
Good morning. We'll be talking about the Venetian Empire, which began when the Roman Empire in the West stopped in the 5th century and expanded for almost 1,000 years. It was founded in a swamp, a trap for millions of mosquitoes in the northern end of the Adriatic, seemingly uninhabitable. Yet the Venetians made of it a great force, dealing with the Byzantine Empire and the Ottoman Empire and the Holy Roman Empire as a key middleman between Asian trade and Europe, designing great ships in the arsenal and creating St. Mark's and artwork to match anything in the Renaissance. That's the Venetian Empire with Stephen Bird, Marcia van Helder and Georg Christ on Radio 4 on BBC Sounds just after 9 o'clock. Now back to today.
Thanks, Melvin. Let's have a look at the weather today. It'll be cloudy and breezy across western Scotland with drizzle, rain for the Northern Ireland, cloudy for Northern Ireland. Everywhere else, drier with sunny spells and variable cloud.
You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Johnny Diamond. It's 25 minutes to 9. Let's get a summary of the news with Caroline Nicholls.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has acknowledged that the tax rise for businesses announced in yesterday's budget is likely to lead to small pay rise increases for workers. But Ms Reeves told us she'd made the right decisions for the country. The International Monetary Fund has said it supports what it called the sustainable tax rises in the budget. Emergency rescue efforts are underway to find people missing after heavy flooding in the Valencia region in Spain. At least 95 people are known to have died. North Korea has fired an intercontinental ballistic missile, which flew for nearly an hour and a half before falling into the sea near Japan. The North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, said it was a warning to enemies who threatened his country's security. The United States called it a breach of UN resolutions. Protection zones around abortion clinics in England and Wales have come into force, making it illegal to protest within 150 metres of them. Silent prayer won't be automatically banned.
Thanks very much, Caroline. War has a new sound, the thin whine of drones that both spot targets and bring death to those in their sights. Drones have changed the war in Ukraine, and they're used extensively by both the Ukrainian and Russian militaries. But increasingly, there is evidence that Russia is using drones also to target civilians. The Ukrainian government says there's been a sudden surge in drone attacks on civilians in the southern Kherson region in the past 3 months, in which at least 30 people have been killed and more than 400 injured. Russia's military has not responded to the BBC's questions about the allegations. From Kherson, Yoga Telemaya reports with Imogen Anderson and Sanjay Ganguly.
In the city of Kherson, there are constantly drones hovering over us. It is a constant threat. And the only real mitigation against that is to drive at a really high speed. So that's what we're doing right now to get from place to place.
In what is considered a relatively safe area in the city, in a shed-like structure, we meet Dmytro, a 22-year-old volunteer who's one of more than 400 civilians injured in drone attacks since the 1st of August.
He, in fact, was chased by a drone, which then dropped the explosive it was carrying. He's got an injury to his ear. In fact, he's still got shrapnel lodged close to his ear because the doctor says it's too dangerous to try to take it out. And he's also got a video of how exactly the incident happened, which he's going to show us now.
In the video, a drone can be seen as it buzzes over a makeshift bus stop. Then it fires. Is everyone okay? A man shouts. The camera then shows Dmytro, blood gushing from his right ear.
The drone attacks have intensified since July. And it's not 5 or 10 of them, it's hundreds of them. They constantly circle, from morning till night, every day. The Russians are deliberately targeting civilians. They have a Telegram channel on which they post footage from the drones of how they are hunting for cars and people in Kherson. They call it a safari.
We've just finished the interview and some residents have told us to be careful because they say that the sounds of explosions that we're hearing from a little bit away sound like explosives that have been dropped from drones. And we have a drone detecting device, and that is currently telling us that there are 6 drones here, so we're just going to actually try to quickly move to some cover that we found at a coffee shop nearby.
Dozens of civilians have been killed in drone attacks. Serhii, a local trader, was hit by shrapnel when he was in the backyard of his home. His wife of 32 years, Angela, saw it happen. She broke down as she spoke to us.
When he heard the drone, he tried to hide under a tree, but it was so quick. Shrapnel pierced his heart. He was such a good man. Is this the way the Russians have decided to fight? By just killing civilians who walk in the street?
Just a few minutes' drive away, I've come to an automobile repair shop in Kherson where we're meeting a woman, Olena, who had gone into a building to get a manicure, and then she heard a loud explosion. When she came out, she found a drone had dropped a bomb on her car. I'm just looking at the car right now and there's a huge hole in the roof where something's gone through it. The car seats are fully ripped apart. The door frame has come loose. There are shreds and little bits of plastic and metal and wire just scattered all over the floor.
And it's quite clear that with the kind of damage that I can see, it's quite clear that had she been in this driving seat, this bomb or grenade or whatever was dropped would have either caused serious injury or more likely would have caused death.
I don't look like a military person. My car is not a military car. Don't they see that?
We go further into the city to one of a handful of aid distribution centres operating in Kherson.
The sound you hear there, that's a drone detector telling us that there are drones overhead. I'm just looking at the screen and there are at least four. That's as many as the detector can show us at one time. We're at a center where a charity distributes food and supplies to residents in Kherson. We've been hearing lots of artillery shelling as well in the last 10 minutes or so. So there's multiple threats here. We've had to run in very quickly from our car into this building. And we can see people coming in, mostly elderly people who are going to come in to get here some food and supplies.
Bendu Singh, who runs the aid centre, explains why drones are more terrifying than shelling.
It's the enormous difference. So the artillery, there's patterns to the shelling. It's very, very nuanced, but if you're here long enough, you kind of pick those things up, and the people generally manage to live that way. It didn't immobilize the population. The shelling is indiscriminate, but a drone locks on you, and the truth is that's probably game over. You have almost no chance at that point. That's the difference.
Trauma is visible on the faces of everyone we meet at the aid centre. Many tear up when we speak to them. They tell us they're worried things will get worse. That as winter approaches and the leaves fall from the trees, there will be fewer places to hide.
Yogita Limaye reporting there from Kherson in Ukraine. It is 17 minutes to nine. Once upon a time, someone pondered how to describe a seminar that was being held over the internet. They came up with the hideously ugly word, webinar. That kind of effort clearly got the people at Radio 4 thinking about how to find the word to describe the things that we all feel but somehow don't have the right word for. Unspeakable starts on Radio 4 this evening at 6:30.
You know the person, the neighbour, who always puts their bin out first on bin day? You know exactly which one it is. Everyone else follows suit. They are a binfluencer. So that one I'd love to have claimed. And the second one is snaccident, which is the inadvertent eating of an entire packet of biscuits when you're meant to have just the one. And you can, I have recently discovered, have a gincident.
The show is presented by author, broadcaster and lexicographer Susie Dent and comedian and actor Phil Wang. Welcome to you both. It's very good to have you here. Susie, can I start with you? There's clearly a lot of fun in these shows that you've recorded, but there's also a serious point, isn't there, about how language is moulded?
Yes, and it is all, of course, about usage. English is a democracy, so it is down to us to create the words that we need and to fill the gaps. And some of them do seem quite startling, although one of the things that we do try to do on Unspeakable is to bring back words that have inexplicably faded from view, and we introduce some of those as well, particularly from local dialect, words like tartle, which is to hesitate when you're introducing someone because you've completely forgotten their name. And that exists in Scots, but right, we somehow have overlooked it. So you're right, though. It is that there are insufficiencies in language, and often we know we turn to other languages, the so-called untranslatables, to fill those lexical gaps.
Phil, were there favourite words that came out of the series for you? I have to say, gincident is pretty good.
Gincident has happened to us all, I think. Some very good words, some very practical words. Miles Jupp came up with the word ap nauseam, which is when you are fed up by the sheer abundance of apps you have to download these days just to get through everyday life. The parking apps seem to come to mind. There's about 100 different ones that you have to download just to park a car.
We heard binfluencer as well, which sticks in the head. Are there differences? You have a shared British and Malaysian heritage. Do you have frustration over when there are words in some languages that describe things and that that just don't work in English?
Oh, right, yes. There are some brilliant words in Malaysian slang. There's a word called gelip, which is when something just kind of makes your skin crawl, you know. And I grew up saying, kids would always say, oh, you just say gelip, gelip. But there's no such word in English. Hmm. And so there definitely are gaps to be filled. And I think the show is going to go some way to doing that.
Susie, is this about language catching up with modernity, or is it actually about refashioning language to reflect what goes on every day?
Yes, I think a bit of both, actually, Johnny, because the second point that you make there, very often we do repurpose. You know, language is incredibly circular, so something may drift from view and then come back as we need it. We still surprisingly hold on to words from the past as well, even as technology moves on. So we dial a phone, we hang up, even though that's clearly not what we're doing on our smartphones now. So it is sometimes incredibly slow, but it's also very, very versatile. And I think, you know, it'll always go its merry way, but usually it does do what we need it to do.
And Phil, is this series more than just punning around?
Well... There definitely are a lot of puns, and I think when coming up with a new word, the mind naturally goes to puns. But there have been some words which seem completely new and not based on existing words. Like Jack D came up with sprank, which is when you use words that are too young and cool for you to say, that you're too old to say these young words now. So if someone in the studio today were to say something was slay, you'd be accused of spranking, I'm afraid.
Well, there'll be no spranking in this studio, I promise you that. Phil, Susie, thank you very much. Best of luck with the series. It goes out, it starts on Radio 4 this evening at 6:30.
It sounds like a treat. There are all those legacy words. I want a legacy gesture, because you pretend you're writing out of the bill at a restaurant.
Yeah.
But nobody pays like that anymore. You do anyway. So well, come up with ideas. It's 12 minutes to 9 now. We invited you to send us or to WhatsApp or email with questions about the budget, not just about how it might affect you, but what your questions were about how it might affect the country as a whole. Questions perhaps the Chancellor, Shadow Chancellor, leader of Liberal Democrats addressed earlier in the programme, or maybe they didn't. Well, we're delighted to say our business editor, Simon Jack, is in the studio with us, alongside Claire Barrett, consumer editor for the Financial Times. And we've got a range of your questions, which Johnny and I will take us through. I'm going to start with one, which is about the impact on business, which in many ways was the focus of my interview with Rachel Reeves earlier at 8:10. Dave in Leyland says, with inflation-busting minimum wage increases, employers' national insurance increases, employers' NI thresholds reduced, we might want to explain that one, how is the private sector supposed to drive growth, Simon, first of all?
Well, that's a very good question, and the answer is that I haven't spoken to a single business who thinks it will drive growth. And not only that, but the OBR agrees. They say that inflation is going to be a bit higher than it otherwise would have been. And that although there's a little boost to growth in the early years, that tails off. And in fact, they think growth is going to be less strong in years 3, 4, and 5 of this parliament than it otherwise would have been. What the businesses I speak to say that basically my wage bill is going up. That means that I might have to put prices up, or start docking hours, or even make some redundancies. So in terms of, if this is meant to be a pro-business, pro-growth budget, this is a funny way of going about it, because it's going to reduce all of those things.
Mm. And there's been a lot of talk about the threshold that people might not quite have got their heads round yet this morning. So the rate of tax, national insurance, that employers pay is going up from 13.8% to 15% next April. But the slice of earnings that this tax is going to apply to will be significantly expanded. So, for example, at the moment, if you're employing two people part-time and they're both doing 15 hours per week, your NI bill will be quite small compared to one worker doing 30 hours per week. But from April, that change is going to go away, because the national insurance is going to be applied to much more of a worker's salary. So we are going to see second-order effects in the labour market that we can't quite fathom. Businesses are working it out this morning after the budget and
just
seeing what will we do.
For people who are not business owners listening, what it means, does it, is that people are sitting there with the calculator saying, if I do somebody part-time, if I don't have them as an employee, if I treat them as self-employed. Yeah. In other words, huge number of calculations, maybe with your accountant or something else to say, how do I get someone cheaper?
At the moment, if you pay someone more than £9,100 a year, that's about 175 quid, then you start paying employers' national insurance contributions. They have lowered that threshold to 5,000, which is roughly £100 a week. So many more people, employers who may have part-time employees, as Claire was saying, will start being, will have to pay national insurance where previously they didn't.
Mm. And things that they could do, hiring freezes, pay rise freezes, if you're trying to get a rise out of your employer, good luck with that. But also, some FT readers have been commenting on our stories and saying, well, actually, we're going to invest in automation and AI, because if it's very expensive to employ people, then let's invest in the robots.
And let us not forget, this comes on top of a couple of weeks ago, we got a huge plethora of new employment rights and protections against things like sick pay from day one, unfair dismissal protection. So basically a lot of employers are saying, not only is it going to be more expensive to employ people because of the NI rise, it's a riskier venture because it's going to be more difficult to fire people if they're not a good fit. All of that added up, a lot of people say, is a deterrent to hiring more people, and that is not a great way to grow the economy.
Let's stick with national insurance. We've got a fair number of questions about it. One from Kevin Bowman, I hope I pronounced that correctly. He asks, the OBR, Office of Budget Responsibility, says 3/4 of the national insurance rise on business will be passed on to employees via lower wages. Why is it this much, and how does this transmission mechanism work? Simon.
So it's very important. What the OBR said is 3/4 of the NI rise on business will be passed on to employees via lower real wages. Okay. That's the important distinction. Because basically, the OBR is saying inflation is going to be higher as a result of this than it otherwise would have been. And that means that wages go less far in a higher inflation environment. Yeah. So what they're saying is that 3/4 of this burden on business will actually be absorbed by employees because their wages won't go as far.
How do they know that? Is that one of those sort of magical economic assumptions?
It is. Well, these are forecasts, so we should definitely point that out. Forecasting is an inexact science, and almost all of the numbers in the OBR report will turn out to be wrong, but they're taking a view about what inflation will do and how far your wages will go.
Right.
Claire, I think it raises a question for us as journalists before we turn to a different subject. Often politicians are accused of coming up with stealth taxes, things that are hard to, using language. There's a reason they do it. It works, doesn't it? We as broadcasters, you in newspapers, find it very difficult to explain. Now, you can be paying quite a lot more tax, but the money on your pay slip is going up, but you can.
Well, it is the cost of employing us that's going to go up. So you're entirely correct. The pay slip numbers could be exactly the same. You won't feel the effects of paying more tax, so those manifesto pledges not to increase income taxes or national insurance on workers have been kept. But arguably, look at the second order effects, especially after April, when these rises kick in and either your pay isn't going to rise as fast. And for some people, unfortunately, I fear the real economic test of this policy will be how many jobs could be lost, how many hours could be cut, how many livelihoods could be damaged, because this is going to have an impact on workers.
There is one important thing we should mention, though, that for the smallest businesses,
yes,
your first £5,000 of national insurance you get a deduction for. That has been expanded to £10,500. So although this is a bombshell for some businesses, they're trying to shield the smallest businesses from that blast.
That was roughly the million that the Chancellor referred to when I spoke to her, and there's 30 million in total businesses. Let's turn to a different subject, getting much less attention, but when Johnny spoke to the leader of the Liberal Democrats, he really highlighted it, the threat, as it is alleged, to family farms. So the question we've got, no name here, but Liz Haynes is a dairy farmer from Stafford, asks us about what the changes to agricultural property relief will be. And we've had another question, same topic, which says, how are Labour going to protect our food security now? Family farmers will have to sell up, won't be able to employ agricultural workers due to the national insurance tax and minimum wage changes. Let's focus on the family farmers selling up, Claire. Why might family farmers have to do it?
OK, well, again, this is the unintended consequence, perhaps, of closing a loophole, as Rachel Reeve said, in inheritance tax laws. So there have been lots of investors who are not farmers, but they've been buying up farmland in recent years. In fact, last year, only 40% of the people who were buying farmland were actually farmers, according to Strutton Parker. The rest were so-called lifestyle investors, people who are wanting to pass on the benefits of owning agricultural land or forestry to their children, their heirs, and not be charged high rates of inheritance tax. Now, this change that she announced yesterday, she's tried to protect farmers by removing some of this valuable relief. The first £1 million of business and agricultural relief will be able to pass tax-free if people are leaving a family farm to the next generation. But after that, you will get some relief, but it will be halved. So, you know, to put it in simple terms, there are going to be higher taxes for large family farms which are being passed on. There's been a huge reaction from the UK farming community. People are saying, well, we might have to sell land and shrink the size of our farms in order to settle IHT bills, along with the reduction in subsidies since we left the EU, and also climate issues, which farmers have been battling recently. If you watch Countryfile, like I do, you'll know all about those. Could all of this affect food security, the actual amount of food that we're able to grow in Britain? And the Country Land and Business Association certainly think it will.
I mean, Claire, the presumably this is part of the Treasury sort of hunting out what it sees as tax dodges and saying, right, well, that people are clearly shuffling money into agricultural land, so let's give that a squeeze instead.
Yes, and there are also other things that are going to be affected. I mean, the AIM markets in London, the alternative investment markets, where lots of small businesses list. If you hold shares in certain AIM companies for 2 years, you've been able to pass those on inheritance tax-free. That relief is going to be reduced. And also that ability to pass on your workplace pension tax-free. Yeah. That's also going to be changed.
That's always been a bit of a weird one. The fact that was exempt. Mm. But I think there's a thematic approach here. But if you look at the things they're trying to tax, they see that there's a baby boomer generation who have accumulated enormous amounts of wealth in shares, property, farms, whatever. And that is going to be passed by a generation at some point. And if you like, there's this kind of migration of money which is going sweeping across there. And they want to be in the middle of that to take a piece out of it to try and equalise that sort of generational wealth gap.
I'm going to squeeze in one more question. It comes from Alwyn Cole. I think it's probably one for you, Simon. How much of the money given to the NHS and schools will be returned to the government in employer NI contributions?
That's quite an easy one. If you look in the Red Book, they're basically the overall bill for national insurance rises is £25 billion. There's a section right underneath that which says £5 billion of that will be reshuffled, will be repurposed back. So that those institutions won't be hit by the same tax rise.
Okay, thanks very, very much to both of you, Claire Barrett, Simon Jack. Thank you. And of course, thank you to everyone who sent in their questions. Sorry if we didn't get round to yours.
That is not the whole of the budget, of course. There's plenty of good news that people are tweeting saying, why don't you focus on that? Well, inevitably, we focus on the questions that people have got about potential problems on the day after, but that good news will unfold. You'll get some of that if you listen back to the interview I did with the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, earlier. If you missed it, or if you want to listen back, we are putting it up on BBC Sound. You search for the Today podcast, the whole of that interview there. And straight after this programme, I'll be then recording a regular episode of the Today podcast with more analysis of the budget. What we now know on the morning after the budget before, with my former BBC colleague, former BBC economics editor, now at Bloomberg, Stephanie Flanders, and the economist Tim Loynick. He'll be with us as well. And if you want to get that, you go to BBC Sound, search for the Today podcast.